the film The Lovers, Azza Jacobs, book list editor Donna Seaman, and from the Netflix show Love, Chicagoan Chris Witaski. Now, here's your host, a man who lists double parking as a skill on his resume, Justin Kaufman.
I'm pretty good at it. Like, it's all about confidence. It's about, I mean, even if it's a two-laner like Ashland, you double it, you show a little bit of confidence, everyone's like, I respect you. A good double park essentially tells people, hey, I've been here before. I know what's up. The reason I bring it up is like I will sometimes drive in and I will take Monroe in all the way to Wacker Drive. And cabs there love to double park in the left-hand turn lane to get onto Wacker. And it just causes the biggest skirmish. I mean, it's like chaos. It's like people, it's like by doing that, it's like a scene from I Am Legend. Everyone's trying to get off the island. And they don't care. They just sit there like, I double park for a living. And there's something about it where, you know, I go by with my scowl on my face and I'm like, you do. And you wear it well. Good evening, everybody. Justin Kaufman here in the download with you till 11 o'clock here in 720 WGN. What a beautiful, beautiful night. This is what I'm talking about. Oh, man, we've been looking forward to this. I think it was last night that days run together. But last night, I mean, wasn't it the gray skies and the thunderstorms? And there was sort of like a throwback feeling to February. And then today, the sun is cascading off the Wrigley Building. There are different lights illuminating Michigan Avenue and Wacker Drive. It's beautiful out here. Beautiful. We have a beautiful show for you tonight. Great show about the arts, architecture, theater. We're also going to talk about social media, a new study from the Associated Press and the Nork Center at the University of Chicago, essentially a research center that looks into several issues in society, but this one in particular, how teenagers are viewing their social media habits. And we'll talk about this all the time, right? I mean, anyone who has a teenager who's listening right now understands that at a certain point, you're like, you need to get off that screen. Well, it's interesting. I mean, they studied hundreds of teenagers, and they came up with the idea that teenagers are probably more balanced when it comes to social media than adults. Essentially, they will take breaks, voluntary breaks. They will walk away from Snapchat, from Facebook, from Twitter, from video apps, things of that nature. Let's take a week off. It might be because they're overloaded. It might feel that they just are done with it. But it's very interesting to take a look at a generation that has essentially lived a digital life. I, at 42 years old, had a life where there wasn't digital. So it's interesting to see the sort of, as we called it, the digital indigenous. And we'll see what we can learn from the patterns that they... the patterns that are there. I mean, that's something that we should pay a very close attention to and maybe glean what we can better understand about ourselves. You ever take a social media break, Pete?
I'm sorry. I was on Facebook. I wasn't even paying attention. You say something?
Sorry, Snapchatting. Have you ever done that? Have you ever taken a week off?
No, I haven't.
I just did it. I did it for when we went on vacation for spring break. I shut the whole thing down. I was like, I'm going to have a vacation instead of documenting my vacation. And I don't think I changed at all as a human being. So
yeah.
You think that there might be some miraculous moment where you're like, oh, I smell again. I could smell the roses, but you don't.
What about, I could probably put my phone away for a few days, but what about... You know, like I'll have CNN on at all time in the background, right. Or I'll have ESPN. Like I'm always, there's got to be some sort of media in my face.
Yeah, I don't know. That might be a whole other study.
get on it.
The scrolls, we have to get on it. My guest at the big table tonight, filmmaker Azza Jacobs. He is the man behind The Lovers, the new Deborah Winger Tracy Letts vehicle. Great tagline, by the way. The tagline is a movie about marriage for those who survive it. It's a comedy, and it's a tremendous storyline. We'll get into it coming up at 8 o'clock. Azza Jacobs is my guest tonight at the big table. Coming up at 9, Donna Seaman will be here. We'll talk about the American Writers Museum. Also, Chris Witaski will be here. Talk to him about his show Netflix's Love. Chris, of course, from Second City here in Chicago. The 10 o'clock hour, Chris Jones gonna come by from the Chicago Tribune, the chief theater critic. We'll talk about Mother's Day selections. We'll also talk about what's coming up this summer and the Tony Awards, the Tony nominations, things of that nature. So all that tonight on the download. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I am Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, let's get the show on the road. We got a big one tonight. Why don't we start with the carryout? Here are today's top stories. I don't even know where to start with the continuing spin over the firing of FBI Director James Comey. It's hard to even follow. It's like a game of telephone. Jimmy wants to go out with you. Jimmy wants to play peekaboo? No. Jimmy wants to go to Bonner? Who's Jimmy? The White House and the FBI seem to be at odds on who said what, when, and how many times, and how big all of this should be. And President Trump isn't helping his own story. First, it was a recommendation from the Department of Justice, but then he said in an interview with NBC that he was pondering the made-up Russia investigation and just acted. Oh. Then President Trump seemed to muddy waters further by saying that he talked with the FBI Director James Comey about whether or not he was under investigation 3 times, which is troubling because why? Why? Why are you calling the FBI director? Also, you don't have anyone else to do that for you? You don't have like a deputy something or another? An assistant? A bagman? I mean, we watch Veep, right? You couldn't get Gary to do it? So weird. It's the president. Hey, am I under investigation? Thanks. Come on. Right now, if you're a liberal, you're saying impeach. If you're a conservative, you're saying who cares? To which liberals respond, election. And conservatives say emails. And I just summed up everybody's Facebook page, right? All in one quick summation. What I think is a bigger story was that the interview President Trump gave to The Economist. Did you see this, Pete? When talking about his economic plans, he used the phrase, quote, prime the pump. And then he said, and I quote, have you heard that expression used before? Because I haven't heard it. I mean, I came up with it a couple days ago and I thought it was good. I mean, it's what you have to do. That can't be real. I mean, it really is it possible that Donald Trump is Andy Kaufman? I mean, is this just a whole bit and he's just loving every minute of it? I mean, today he went and got into a Twitter war with Rosie O'Donnell. Again! Sorry to yell there. Jeez Louise. Governor Rauner attended graduation ceremonies at Chicago State University today. When he was introduced, he was booed. Of course, Chicago State's seen its share of troubles thanks to the budget stalemate. But you know what? I give Rauner credit for showing up. I mean, he had to know that was going to happen. And his response, I'd love to boo our system as well. That's a strong comeback. Rauner's getting this. It's taking a couple years, but he's getting it. I don't know. If I were at a graduation and I got booed, then I had to sit through like a 2-hour ceremony. It'd be really hard. Also, Chicago State, you got the governor of Illinois. The best I got was a jazz singer. That's not accurate. I also got Senator Columbia College. I had Senator Paul Simon. How cool is that, right? He phoned it in. Macy's reported terrible first quarter numbers, amounts to a 39% loss in first quarter profits. I blame it on the thermostat in their State Street store. I mean, you go there in the wintertime with your coat and it's so hot and you got to lug the coat around. Oh, no, I'm out. I'm ordering online. Today was the last day for Steve Harvey's show in Chicago. He's leaving for L.A. to rebrand the show. Just Steve. Okay. He didn't bring any of his staff from Chicago, so they're out of jobs. And to repay Harvey for that move, they sent Robert Feeder a Harvey memo where he gets all crappy and says, don't talk to me in the hallways. It's a classic memo. Read it at Feeder's blog. It's the greatest. It's a written version of, we'll do it live! We'll do it live! It's so good, it's gone super viral. Again, Harvey doesn't have a deputy, a senior producer, a grip that could just stand outside the dressing room. No, he's got it. No, there's absolutely no need to send that email, dude. When asked about the email today, he said he's not going to apologize. So he cuts the jobs to move to L.A. He yells at some staff not to look at him in the hallway. All right. Well, it's a small industry. I'm sure that won't come back to haunt you when you're trying to get someone to buy your sandwich when you're hosting Showtime at the Apollo in 5, 10, 15 years when you're back. Does he still do that? Does he still do that like on the side? He was really good at that, by the way. In weather, all right, this is more like it, right? Now let's add 10 degrees, keep it going. In sports, the Cubs have the night off after losing to the Rockies. Both Addison Russell and Anthony Rizzo sat out yesterday with nagging injuries. Hayward already on the DL, but you know what? That's fine because you got the depth. What you don't want to see is any of the starting pitchers go down with injuries. That's usually the telltale that this season will be different than the last. So far, so good. The Cubs, they'll turn it around. Also, Justin Grimm sent to the minors. Jameer Candelario stays in the bigs. He could be a serviceable outfielder in Hayward's absence, or at least carry the bags. Right? He could be the guy. Seriously, he could write the memo. Don't look at Rizzo in the eyes, guys. Tomorrow night, Cubs Cardinals. Ooh, good weekend series. The Sox need a victory tonight at the G-spot to split the series and end a four-game skid. They're currently 2.5 back and a couple more untimely losses, and they're pretty much out of this thing. Got to turn it up, turn it around. The right guy's on the mound tonight, Derek Holland, the former Ranger left-hander, is having a career resurgence on the south side. So let's keep it going. Also, who's even on the Twins these days? Justin Morneau still play there? Torrey Hunter? Rob Deer? Frank Viola still pitching? Burt Bylevin? Bylevin on the mound tonight? The ghost of Kirby Puckett? No? In hockey, the Anaheim Ducks move on. They'll be facing the Nashville Predators in the Western Conference Final. In the East, Ottawa takes on Pittsburgh. Anaheim and Ottawa? Yeah, all the way. Another blowout in the NBA playoffs last night as the Celtics routed the Wizards. These series might be close, but each game is a blowout. Is there anything worse than blowout playoff basketball? It's so dumb. Bears rookie minicamp's underway. Mitchell Trubisky's there. He arrived in his grandma's 1997 Toyota Camry. I don't trust a franchise quarterback who doesn't drive an Escalade. Also, the Bears released wide receiver Eddie Royal and Will Sutton today when healthy Eddie Royal looked like a pro, but he was hurt all the time. Will Sutton was a third-round pick in 2014. Who from 2014 has even left? Third round. Ugh, cut. But good news, former New York Giants wide receiver Victor Cruz is supposed to visit Hallis Hall on Monday. Cruz, remember the salsa dance? Dun-dun, he scored a touchdown to the salsa dance? Yeah, we need more of that. Come on, sign him. Finally tonight, scientists found evidence of a new dinosaur in Montana that roamed the earth millions of years ago. They named it Zool because it looks like the dog-like creature from Ghostbusters. So that's where Rick Moranis went. Yeah. That's the carryout for May 11, 2017. Hey, it's so nice out. We turned the old orange drink machine on. Probably should have cleaned it out from last year. So sticky. All right, coming up, we'll talk about teens and their social media habits. Also, in the 8 o'clock hour, director Azza Jacobs will be here. Talk about his film, The Lovers. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martz here. How are you tonight, my friend?
Justin, you know, up here in the newsroom, I'm more than just a pretty face. I like to offer up yes. information whenever I can. Ooh. So I took the opportunity to look up the definition for you of prime the pump.
Yes, good.
Prime the pump. According to idioms.thefreedictionary.com, prime the pump is to do something in order to make something succeed, especially to spend money, i.e., European governments and banks are priming the pump worldwide, right, looking for alternative energy.
Now, does it say that it was originated a week ago? It's the first time we heard it?
Its origins are from the late 1800s.
I was going to say May 3rd.
Yeah.
Darn it, I was off by a couple of centuries.
Informal prime the pump means to encourage the growth or action of something. So, for instance, before I go out with my friends, I'll have a beer and say that I'm priming the pump before we go out drinking.
Pretty soon, I wouldn't be surprised if that phrase is patented, trademarked at some point, and we're all paying money to President Trump for
Wait,
it.
Wait, hang on. Call my attorney. Okay.
Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 8 o'clock, Azza Jacobs is going to be here, filmmaker. His new film, The Lovers, starring Deborah Winger and Tracy Letts, Chicagoan. As love the tagline for the movie. It's a movie about marriage and those who survive it. That is the movie we're going to be talking about coming up in the 8 o'clock hour. Well, a new study's out by the Associated Press NORC, Center for Public Affairs Research at the University of Chicago, and it explores the world of teenagers and social media. They polled teenagers on how often they take social media breaks and what leads to that decision. It's an interesting study to understand the importance of a teen's digital life, especially for a generation that knows nothing else. What were the findings? Well, kids may be doing a better job of detoxing digitally than we do. In studio tonight, Amanda Lenhart. She's a senior researcher for APNORC and an expert on youth, families, and digital technology. Amanda, thanks for coming in. We appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So let's talk about this study. I mean, right away, this is a study that you guys did to really find out about taking time off from social media.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things, so we did this study on a nationally representative panel, the AmeriSpeak panel at NORC, and we looked at about 790 teenagers between the ages of 13 and 17. And we wanted to find out a lot of things about their social media practices. But one of the things we were really curious about was, you know, we hear a lot about teens saying that they're so intensely in love with social media. That's the sort of reputation that teens have. But in fact, we'd been hearing in focus groups that teens were taking some time off. And we wanted to find out, really, was that the case? And how often did it happen?
Yeah, because it almost becomes a stereotype of all these teenagers and their screens, just not unlike other generations of teenagers and their radio or teenagers and their, you know, whatever it is. But there is, I mean, I think if you asked anybody on Michigan Avenue right now listening, walking past the studio, they go, oh, yeah, teenagers are addicted to social media.
Right. And it turns out they do love social media a lot. It connects them to their friends and to their family and into information and news. But they also take breaks from it. And more than half of teenagers that we talked to said, I've taken a break from social media.
And what does that mean? What's a break?
You know, we left it very open. It turns out the typical break is a week or longer, in fact. And so these aren't actually just short breaks that teens are taking. They're relatively long. And these are taking time away. We, in fact, asked if you kind of snuck back on your social media, and it turns out most people don't. It's a pretty clean break. And we find that there's really different kinds of breaks. There's involuntary breaks and voluntary breaks.
Right. This is a big distinction. The voluntary, there's a different set of numbers, but involuntary as well. I mean, this could be anything from being grounded to a device being broken or stolen to anything else, right?
Going to camp, you know, going camping in the woods with your parents and your phone doesn't work. So yeah, there's a variety of reasons why kids take involuntary breaks. And then the voluntary ones are often for reasons around managing toxic relationships and challenges, feeling overwhelmed by information, feeling like you have other things that you need to do with your time, that your life is out of balance and you find that social media is taking up too much of it. And so teens put a break there.
Our teens are articulating that in the study? I mean, the idea of talking about sort of losing time and you know, not being able to manage relationships?
They are. That's some of the options that we gave them in the questions that we asked were about how you're managing these relationships and how what are the reasons why you take these breaks when you take it voluntarily. And those are the reasons that teens told us. I have other things I need to do with my time, whether it's schoolwork or I've got a sports that I need to work on and I just don't have time anymore. To I'm over it. I'm exhausted by it. It takes too much time and energy to maintain these relationships and manage the drama.
Does anything about this study and you know, you've been doing this for a while, researching not just here but at Pew, your other places. Does any of this surprise you as somebody who has studied teenagers, studied digital lives, studied all of the things we're talking about tonight?
Well, I was surprised by the number of teens who had taken a break, really. I thought the number would be a lot lower. A lot of the work I've done over the years shows how deeply embedded these platforms are in teens' lives, how important they are to their peer relationships particularly, but also to family and broader relationships. And so to see teens saying, hey, this is exhausting. I need to take a break from this. I need to find ways to manage this is a little, I think it's heartening for all of us, right? It's a message for adults as well as kids,
right?
That this is something that you can manage.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I kind of tongue in cheek kind of said at the top that maybe teenagers are doing a better job than adults, because I don't know if I could, just from anecdotal information, point out, you know, 6 in 10 adults that are taking week-long breaks from social media.
Right. I mean, I think certainly adults do it. I don't have good data about the number of adults who do. You know, I see it on my social media feed, whether it's people signing off for a trip or people saying, I'm over this politics stuff. I'm signing off for for 2 weeks and letting things cool down. So certainly I think adults do it. But I think many of us often feel overwhelmed by having to manage our social media platforms and having to manage our profiles in the same way that kids do. And that it is possible to take these breaks. I think, you know, these moments away to refocus our lives in different ways is valuable.
It's amazing to me to think that kids are actually on their own voluntarily saying, I'm going to stop doing this, you know, because I going back to the sort of stereotype, is not unlike the stereotype of, oh, they're just, you know, these kids, they just care about their screens or what's in front of them. There's also a stereotype that they don't have sort of control over it, or that their impulse control has not been developed, or they're not mature enough to make decisions like this.
Right. And we do see that it's older teens who are more likely to take the voluntary breaks, who are the ones who are sort of dropping a line and saying, OK, here's where I need space from these platforms. And younger teens are more likely to have the phone taken away or the platform taken away by parents. So I think there is a level of maturity that happens as teens get older, where they are able to sort of get some distance from the platforms and take those physical breaks.
Amanda Lenhart is a senior researcher at APNORC. They just put out a study on teenagers and taking breaks from social media. You can find that study at the website APNORC.org. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. There's much more to talk about. We could talk a little bit about how important it is to study this. As we sort of set up at the top this idea of being this is a digital indigenous generation. This is, you know, they know nothing else. So how important is it for researchers and for people paying attention to this to study the habits of this generation? Amanda Lenhart in studio. We'll take a quick break. Come back. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, Amanda Lenhart. She's a senior researcher for APNORC, which is a research center here at the Public Affairs Research Center at the University of Chicago. And they just put out a study that explores the world of teenagers and social media and essentially the idea of teenagers taking a break. And that's what we're talking about tonight. You know, as we said right before the break, we talked about the concept of, you know, studying this generation or a generation of people who have never lived an adolescent day without a digital world around them. You know, I can speak for myself. There was a time where that didn't happen. You know, I was exposed to that when I was already an adult.
Right.
So the idea of studying how teenagers, even young teenagers, get into this, why is it important to study this?
We need to know the kind of environment that our kids are living in. I mean, this isn't a different space for teenagers. This isn't like a separate universe. This is actually where life is lived. This is where relationships are managed and maintained. This is where news is learned, right? It is the same as the hallways of your high school. It's not a different place. And we need to, I think as adults, we come to it with a really different perspective, right? We're not comfortable in the space necessarily. We don't have the same memories of growing up in it. So I think it's important for us. I think of my research as helping young people talk to adults and help them understand their experiences and help adults understand the experiences, both positive and negative, so that we can think about good ways to make policy and rules and platforms that help teens and are as positive as we can make them.
Well, the research community, and I think the academic community, and in some cases the government, probably paid close attention to this stuff. But when you think about these platforms, whether they be Twitter, Facebook, other places, Snapchat, they're not necessarily, you know, they don't really care what's happening to a 13-year-old. They just want the clicks. They want people on. So at what point does the responsibility go to the platform when people are saying it might be good to take a break and the platform's like, don't take a break, that hurts my bottom line?
Right. I mean, you're absolutely right. Like, the whole point of these platforms is to keep you coming back over and over so that they learn more about you and so that they can sell the advertising to your eyeballs. I mean, that's the point. And really, really smart people spend a lot of time figuring out how to do that and how to do that in a way that's seamless. And so it's in some ways hard for us to fight back against that stickiness. I think we as adults need to, think about how we help our kids manage that kind of stickiness. And, you know, I think when we think about responsibilities of platforms, they are private, right? They're private companies that own these platforms. It's not these kinds
it's
of
not the
rules.
Public space,
it's
right.
not a public space. Free speech doesn't apply. Now, they have incentives to make sure that kids don't get hurt on their platforms. They don't want that any more than the rest of us do. But they have all these competing, you know, rules and policies they need to manage, you know, for free speech versus safety of kids versus making a profit versus keeping people, like, you know, having people have healthy relationships. So there's a lot of competing priorities. And I'm sympathetic to the challenges of the platforms, but at the same time, I think there are also, you know, things that can be done to help make this better.
Two questions I have about relationships. Mm-hmm. You mentioned a little bit earlier just the idea of a lot of teens suggest that taking a break surrounds toxic relationships, you know, where things go wrong on social media. We've seen this with online bullying, but we've also just seen it with, you know, drama that's usually, like you said, reserved to the hallways of high school are now playing out on social media every night.
Yeah.
You know, when you think about that, how do you address that? How do you address the idea that this generation's language, culture, everything else is different in the way that they're not necessarily basing their relationship on an eye to eye? We know each other as human. We now it's all digital.
Right. I mean, I do think we should remember that your average teenager does spend 8+ hours in the halls of their high school interacting with people face to face. Right. So unless you're going to school online, which some are, but most aren't, you do have that like face to face interaction.
Right.
But I do think it's important to remember that, yeah, these are really challenging spaces. They're different than face to face interaction. We don't have the same kind of information about the person we're talking with. You can't see, I couldn't see you nodding across the table. I can't see your body language. I can't hear the tone of your voice. And so we've created things like emoji and emoticons to kind of help us add, you know, that stuff back into these textual interactions. But it's really challenging. It's like the reason why you should never kind of get mad at somebody for an email that they send you, because its tone is often lost in text. and so you can think about those emails where you were like, I should have really just not been mad. But so I think one of the tasks we have as adults is helping teens learn how to grow up to be, you know, functional adults in these spaces. And that's hard enough for us.
Yeah. And I mean, you spent your career working, you know, with youth, with families. And that's the second part of my question, is about the relationship between parents and the kids. Let's focus on a young teenager, someone who is just starting out in their social media world. As a parent who might be listening right now, what can you do? What I mean, besides the idea of monitoring or sort of parenting with a heavy hand, what do you do to make sure that they are having robust non-toxic relationships, if you will?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's having, you know, it's the thing that you never want to hear, which is that you need to talk to your kids. You need to keep the lines of communication open with your adolescents, which is easier said than done for everybody out there who's nodding, listening when they have a teenager across the table. It's not that easy. I have some myself. I know it's challenging. So keeping those lines of communication open, things that I really like are sometimes called acceptable use policies or family contracts, family media contracts. And those are things where you sit down as a family and together put together a list of things that, like, these are things that we will do. These are things that we won't do. We might say you turn off the screens at 10 p.m. every night, and that's a family thing. We might say that we will not engage in toxic behavior to our friends in these spaces. And if we do, we lose these privileges. You know, and you can, the nice thing about these contracts is you can customize them for your family. So you get to decide, you know, as the parent, as the teen, what's best for you. Maybe you have a kid who's like super into social media and you need to find a way to help pull them back. Maybe you have a kid who's really got their kind of head screwed on right, and you're okay giving them more kind of leash in the social media space. And so I think you get to decide as a parent with some of these contracts. So that's, you know, and I also really advocate transparency. Like, whatever you're doing, tell your kids that you're doing it. If you're monitoring them, if you're using keyloggers, tell them what you're doing so that they know. It keeps the positive relationship between parents.
You know, as we wrap up in our last question, you know, as you study this a generation that is, as I've been saying, sort of, you know, authentically digital, do you look for, I mean, when you're studying, are you looking for things that might help us understand overall, like, how this is eventually going to play out? I think about, like, almost, you know, things that happened in the 50s and 60s. They were like, ooh, that didn't work out. Technology or whatever that maybe got people sick or did something else. You may always see that with cell phones and things of that nature. But the idea of, are you looking at it as, from a research standpoint, of what this is doing to our society?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of the broad questions that we're asking. And sometimes we're looking at it in real time, and also it's sort of in slow motion, right? We're watching it as it happens. And so I think sometimes we see retroactively what's going on. I mean, one thing I will say is I've been, you know, studying this for, 18 years. And so, you know, the first kids that I looked at are now pretty old. They're starting to have their own kids. And I think it's interesting to start to see, parents who actually have some digital, digital fingerprints know how are they going to parent their own children. And I still think the vast majority of us are turning out okay. So I have some concerns, but I'm not overly worried.
Amanda Lenhart is a senior researcher for APNORC. It's the Center for Public Affairs Research at the University of Chicago. She's an expert on youth, families, and digital technology. The study about the findings of teenagers taking breaks in social media can be found at APNORC.org. Amanda, thanks for coming in. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
Welcome back to the Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is a screenwriter and filmmaker, Azza Jacobs. His new film is The Lovers, starring Deborah Winger and Tracy Letts. The film is a comedy about a couple stuck in a boring marriage that both have extramarital affairs, and as they get ready to leave each other, they rekindle their relationship. It's a story that lends itself to being a screwball comedy, but in Jacob's hands, it steers far from the rom-com cliche.
I've hardly seen you last week.
I've been overly occupied.
So you're screwing your wife now?
As if.
Mary!
What happened?
Well, you fell asleep on me. That's what happened.
You're a coward, Michael. You need to tell her now.
Everybody knows I'm an idiot, all right? Come back. I'm a moron.
Azza Jacobs is born and raised in New York City, spent most of his time in Los Angeles, but, I mean, he's global at this point, right? His previous work includes the Sundance indie Terry, starring John C. Reilly. For his film The Lovers, it had a successful run at the Tribeca Film Festival, and now it's being released in theaters. It's a pleasure to welcome filmmaker Azza Jacobs to The Download tonight at the Big Table. Azza, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
All right, so let's talk about the film. It's interesting because I kind of said this story lends itself a little bit to being sort of a screwball comedy, but in the way you tell it, it comes across in a whole entirely fresh, unique way. Was that the intention? Was the intention to steer away from the way that this kind of story has been told before?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, not in a way, really. I wanted this film to exist right after those movies end, like whether it was 20 years later or the next day. I wanted to know what happened when those movies, that happily ever after, ended, and what's next with these couples when the screen fades out and there's this swelling music. So that's where this began.
Most of your films and reading about your work, I mean, they all seem to center around the relationship. They're character driven. It's not something that, you're necessarily writing big plot twists, and the movie is about the characters. Talk about that. Talk about your interest in exploring relationships, especially complex ones like these.
Well, I'm always searching for stories that you could summarize the narrative in one sentence. So in this case, I put on the top of the page a couple that cheat on their lovers with each other. It just gives me this place to go in all different directions. The way that I love Chandler or Hammett, that they still have these bones of narrative, but in between it is actually where the story is going on. And that's what I'm interested in. That's where I feel like I can go to these places that are equally light and dark and broad and hopefully narrow, but always reflecting how life feels to me in some way.
Let's talk about just the screenwriter in you. Is that how you like to approach all your work, this idea of taking one sentence or something that you can boil down and exploring it?
Yeah, and I also really like to write about strangers. I find myself being a lot more honest. I feel like I can even, I made a film called Mama's Man with my own parents star in it, and we shot in the home that I was raised. But the son was very different than me, and that was a breakthrough for me because at first I was writing about a son that was very much like myself, and I realized, like, I'm not going to talk about anything I don't want to. I'm not going to go to any place.
Yeah, right.
I want to sell myself. I want to be a cool guy,
Interesting. Like, yeah, right.
So I find myself writing about strangers and seeing, and the farther away, trying to find myself connecting to them, how do I connect, I find it a lot more interesting first off, and I find myself hopefully being a lot more honest.
That's a fascinating look at it, because honesty plays out. I mean, that's a big part of this movie and the ones you play, but the idea of being able to write for strangers, that trait, to find honesty in strangers as opposed to the characters you know. It almost seems like a contrast.
Yeah, well, that contrast is definitely what I'm always looking for. I'm looking for that contrast within ourselves. I see it within myself. I'm a person that I wake up in the morning, I listen to Howard Stern, and then I go to an NPR. I love Sia, I love the Bad Brains. I don't know where the peace is between these things, but I see that, and obviously I see the conflict between us, each other, in much graver terms as well. And I guess I'm trying to not come to peace with it, but I'm just trying to acknowledge that we can go up and down simultaneously sometimes. I want my films to be like
that. Yeah, and beyond honesty, the other thing that is very striking about this film is the idea of conflict and how the characters deal with it. They both are having extramarital affairs. They both have said to their lovers, I'm going to leave them once, you know, once the son comes to visit. We're going to make this happen. Yet that you don't explore that conflict with such explosiveness or with such cliche kind of, oh, the emotions are going to take over. There is a steady calm to the fact that both of these characters know what's going to happen.
That's true. I find the affairs to be such a cliche itself. When you hear somebody say, I'm having an affair, it just sounds, it actually sounds so boring to me, you know? And I feel like I wanted to talk about something, the way that I really see those, when they become more work than the thing you're escaping. You know, Tracy Letts talks about affairs being much more about what the individual needs, like what that person wants of themselves, what they're getting, not really what they're seeing in the other person. Mm-hmm. And that I found really compelling to me. But the drama of so much the schism between them, I like this idea. You know, I'm always looking for characters that I'm going to treat not as villains or victims. But in this case, I could see them both being that. I could see, because right. They're both doing it, it kind of canceled each other out, and neither could claim.
Right. There's no higher ground.
Yeah. And I like that. And I like that they're not even acknowledging that with each other. But you can sense that they're just not asking. It's a, you know, don't
well,
ask,
I mean,
don't tell.
That is a big part of the way that you directed this film. And we talked about the writing of it. But the directing of it, I mean, it's fascinating that the action and the emotion and the conflict comes between the dialogue. You know, there's some times where they're talking to each other, you know, like about whether the toothpaste is gone or whatever it is. And you could tell they really are trying to telegraph something else, yet doing, you know, having mundane conversation.
Well, that's Tracy Letts and Deborah Winger. That's what I get. I mean, that's what I took advantage. I try to take advantage because it was a gift of a lifetime. So those are the things. We stuck to the script. The script stayed the same. And I wrote with a space in there. But really with the hope that this is what I'd see. Oh, in between, how would they say these things that would be truthful? Whether the lines themselves could be, they feel theatric or dramatic or overly more than life is, how would you say this in your life? And that's where I feel like hopefully the real life in the film happens.
Well, I mean, as a director, I mean, how do you direct that way? I mean, when you have such talent like Tracy and Deborah, do you have to say, play it this way, I'd like to see deadpan, this kind of stuff? Or do you let the actors kind of feel their way through it? Because it definitely had a theatrical feel to it.
Yeah. Well, this is a story about people playing roles in their lives. And so that theatrical feeling I wanted, even in the location, I found a house that was a real house that felt like a set to me. And I felt like that was interesting. These people are starring in their own lives. They don't seem to be so concerned outside of their own lives. This, whatever they went searching for, is because they're the leads of their lives at this point. But I let them lead the way, and especially in this case, I try to see, okay, well, this is what you're going to say. This is basically the point, and we know where we're going with this. Where would you say this? How would you walk in and make sure that everything is set up afterwards in terms of the camera, the lights, rather than, okay, I need you to hit this place and hit this place. Always to kind of remember, hopefully to remember, to build after them, you know, showing me what the path is, the most interesting, compelling path.
Filmmaker Aza Jacobs in studio tonight. His film's The Lovers, starring Deborah Winger, Tracy Letts, out in theaters this week. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back more with Aza Jacobs at the big table. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio, Aza Jacobs, the filmmaker. His new film, The Lovers, starring Deborah Winger and Tracy Letts, is in theaters this week. Congrats on the success of the film, too, because this was an independent film that played at the Tribeca Film Festival, is getting a theatrical release. What's that mean to you? Because, you know, you've had a great career, mostly a festival circuit kind of career, and you've been both an experimental filmmaker and an indie filmmaker. What's it mean to you to have a film like this, The Lovers, out in theaters?
It's a great feeling. I mean, I'm somebody that's been, for the past bunch of years, I've been working in TV. I've been working on a show called Doll and M for HBO, and so very, very satisfying. But when you finish, it's out. It's out of your hands. And I'm not looming next to you while you're watching it on TV.
Right,
I got no idea, really. So the Tribeca Festival was last week. That was the first time I saw this movie with an audience.
Wow.
And the first time I heard that it actually is funny to other people besides myself, you know? So it's a thrill. It's really a thrill. It feels alive in a different way. Again, like, I like this idea of going, TV offers me something else. But that sense of thinking, like, okay, what I find funny, some other people do, or what I find interesting, some other people are finding interesting as well. There's always this feeling when I'm making this work, like, is it me? Am I alone here? Is this interesting, or am I just strange? Is this... Because this film really represents my interest and my care and the things. And that has so much to do with A24. You know, I was shooting this film 1 year ago from right now with the knowledge that we're coming out to theaters. Also with an incredible amount of control. They were just ramping
That's
up
great.
On shooting Moonlight. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of, even though they'd proven themselves a distributor, we didn't know they liked my work. I liked what they'd done. But in terms of... We were both hoping for the best. And it wasn't a matter of them going, okay, here's some money, go make your film. It was like, how can we help? Here's the financing to do it, but also how can we be helpful? And in the case of Tracy Letts, Tracy goes out of his way to tell people how little he had ever heard of me before this project. He's like, I never heard of him. No, I mean, I really never heard, not even a single ever, but I did wind up with a script. We you know, after I gave him the script, and besides Deborah Winger being attached, the other thing besides him responding to the script and Deborah was that he saw that it was A24, and he told me the story that he and his wife, every time when they would go to see a movie and they'd respond to it, they kept seeing the same logo. And they thought, like, oh, that's interesting. So when he saw that logo attached to this script, I mean, that's
wow.
amazing
yeah,
to
that
me.
Is, right?
That was the thing that it wasn't, you know, I'd love to say,
yeah.
oh, he loved this film or that film. But again, he really never heard of anything I've done.
Going back to something you said just about whether sometimes you feel like in the business, whether or not you're the only one that laughs at the things that you laugh at or that, you know, are interested in the things that you're interested in. You know, it's interesting to hear that from somebody who's had success. I mean, you just talked about Doll and M. You talked about Terry. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've had a track record of successful projects. Is it always just with you as an artist, as a filmmaker, that you always have to dig within deep to prove yourself to yourself? Like, talk about the emotion of putting your art out there and hoping people understand it.
Yeah, I would... I'm hoping to lose that feeling, you know, because I feel I've been making work that I really like, and I hate the fear that I have sometimes of that, like, at some point somebody's going to say, wait a second, why have you been able to keep doing
right.
this, and you're going to stop, you know, like, and I've been able to pay my rent. I'm not a person that comes from money, but... It's amazing. I am a person that my parents are both artists, and the value of art was always something that was really there for me from the point that I can remember. So, but to be able to pay my bills doing what I care about, I know is a luxury. So it's just one of those things that I feel like, hopefully this is answering your question,
no, it is,
but
yeah.
it's just like, it's always there so far.
Even though
I've felt... I always feel like, is this the last chance that I get to
Well,
do
I just, I know, you know, people who might be listening to this, who may have their own, even outside of art, you know, just a perception of life or who they think they are. I mean, there are times when you doubt yourself, and even as far as you go along, and when we have artists on the show, especially successful ones who are about to put a movie out with Deborah Winger and Tracy Letts in theaters in Chicago, to hear that same sentiment, I think that resonates. The idea that, I think that's a human trait, that even me doing this radio show or someone, you know, working in their in their own respective field has the same feeling.
I hope you're right, and the flip side of that means that I'm still hungry. You know, I think that if I wind up to that place where I feel really confident, oh, I'm going to get to, I'll get another chance at this, then maybe I'll lose that, because I feel like each of these opportunities may be my last opportunity still. And actually, I felt that with even, I know it's crazy to say this, but even with Deborah and Tracy, like, they haven't been as so much more successful than I am myself, than I am, however success I have. They've done so much more and found so much more acclaim for what they've done. I still felt that hunger, and that's the hunger that I'm looking for. I mean, I feel that with the crew. I've been working with the same crew for many, many years. And the truth is that we're still trying to make things that we care for.
Ozzie Jacobson Studio, he's a filmmaker. The movie Lovers comes out this week. And I think back to the characters in the movie, Tracy and Deborah's characters, the concept that it may not be art that they're chasing. Right, might not be chasing that feeling, but they are hungry for happiness, or they're hungry for some void that's there. Maybe it's just some sort of adventure and excitement in their marriage. Talk about writing characters with that want, with that void. I mean, that comes from somewhere. I mean, I'm thinking about just the conversation we were just having. It makes those characters more than one-dimensional. It makes them nuanced.
Well, you know, I guess that's the flip side with stability. I'm somebody that, like I said, have always kind of in some part hoped to know that I'm going to be working tomorrow. And I definitely don't mean this that these people are, like, if they were artists, they would be so fulfilled. I mean, this is something that I feel within what I do. I've fallen into grooves myself where I feel like I've forgotten to communicate. I've been with my wife for 16 years now. And even making a film sometimes feels like it feels like even though we work together, she does the costumes, it still could feel like an affair in its own way, because by the end of the day, you're exhausted and it's hard to communicate. And I feel like so much of what happens to Michael and Mary has to do with just not being able to talk, or losing the energy to talk, or to even more than that, to look at each other.
Yeah.
That's what they get from the others, is that they feel looked at. Not that they're even connecting so much. Oh, this person really likes the same books and movies as me. It's just to be seen.
Yeah, and they go through the same routine. There's so much. Let's do this. Let's take a break, get an update on tonight's news. Ozzie Jacobs, in-studio filmmaker. His film The Lovers, starring Deborah Winger and Tracy Letts, is in theaters this week. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation. Ozzie Jacobs here at the Big Table. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio at the Big Table tonight, filmmaker Ozzie Jacobs. His film The Lovers is in theaters this week, starring Deborah Winger, Tracy Letts. It's a comedy about a couple that's in a boring marriage, that they're both having extramarital affairs. And as they get ready to leave each other, they rekindle the relationship. And it kind of has a twist on who's cheating on who, as the people who are in the affairs are starting to feel like they're cheated on by their respective the couple. It is a storyline, Ozzie, that is reminiscent of that screwball come, that 20s, 30s, 40s kind of thing that we would have seen in early Hollywood. Are you attracted to that kind of story?
Very much so. I love those films. And a lot of, for me, when I watch those earlier films, especially pre-code films, I feel like we're looking at films from the future. It's not so much that we're looking at old films. We're looking at films that I find sometimes much more daring and much more truthful than I see in present day. And so these are films for me to aim ahead for. And also, in a lot of ways, I wanted this movie to be connected to them. The music, definitely.
Yeah,
the score
right,
by
right.
Mandy Hoffman is trying to link up and trying to remind you not only where did these characters come from, some of that romance that you're talking about that happened for these couples, for all these kind of groups of couples, but also those movies and what happens when that score keeps playing in a loop 20 years later and you still have this great, thrilling music. But now, where is it in contrast, and how does it sync up? That's interesting to me.
The relationship, even with everything that's happening and the extramarital affairs that are happening around the marriage, we talked about this a little bit earlier, just the calmness, the patience, if you will, of the two main characters, not recognizing that they are doing these things, but not really willing to change the situation they're in. it was interesting because the drama came from the other side. It almost became the lovers that were in the picture were providing the drama, were actually the ones that were a little bit more unstable. Deborah Winger's character, nonplussed most of the time. Tracy Letts is just, you know, he's digging holes trying to keep the normal. There's something about the whole picture that just you've found a way to rearrange roles.
That's great to hear. Well, I think that so the lovers, Lucy, played by Melora Walters, and Robert, played by Aidan Gillen, the challenge with them is that they're not themselves. They're playing characters that are not happy with themselves, that have lost their stability just by being in this type of relationship.
Both artists, right.
And what Mary and Michael seem to be running from is exactly what's attractive. The fact that they are nonplussed is what's driving them so crazy and also so attractive. Just that they are, they know where they're going to, what's going to happen tomorrow. Maybe that's my way in too, is that I, from this other side of just seeing this couple that, yeah, they're not happy, but they're comfortable.
I think that resonates, and it resonates in this way that, you know, what is happiness, what is comfort? There seems to be a point where the couple is finding their way out by rekindling and stumbling upon great dialogue in there, but just the way that they start to recognize each other again. They start to communicate. They start to connect. But it's the others. It's the lovers in the scenario that stand in the way, whether it be whatever it might, just trying to disrupt the normalcy. When you write like that, when you write in this way that it almost feels like the couple is going to come back together, but there's these obstacles that are stopping them from doing it. Is the intention for the people on the outside to be obstacles?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, when we shoot a film, especially at this size, well, maybe all sizes, we're shooting out of sequence. And so I started by shooting the lovers' relationships first.
Really?
And that creates, I think, an interesting foundation that by the time when we were shooting Deborah and Tracy together, it did feel like that's the affair going on because we had shot both. We'd first established them with these other actors first, and then they fell in sync with those actors first, and then they found each other in sync. I don't think of these characters ever as obstacles. I just think of them. I just see them as part of the complications and trying to make things compelling or interesting.
Yeah. This really is a story that is one that goes after what makes people happy. I mean, happiness, the idea of characters, that should they be together, should they be with their lovers. And in a way, and I don't want to give it away, but it's not the standard way that most of these movies are going to end. Right? And it's not like either they split up and you know, or they go their way or they stay together. I mean, it's a lot more nuanced than that. When you think about how this ends, and that, you always hear that, you know, it's never going to end well. Does it end well for those characters?
For me, it does. And it ends the only way it can. Again, I could be the strange one here, but I see a happy ending. And I don't know if that's is that a spoiler? It's my own version of a happy ending. But this has come up. There was no other thought, really. There was no other way. I felt like I can see now that there could be something that maybe you're inclined to want. And I'm speaking to an audience that hasn't seen the film yet, but their first response could be to maybe, I don't know, whatever the response is. But I think ultimately my guess is that that person would walk away later and then question that final point. And if that final moment wasn't honest, then you'd question everything that preceded it.
Right. It's an interesting conversation just about honesty, about relationships, about conflict, about happiness, about filling that void. The movie is The Lovers. It's out in theaters now. My guest, Azza Jacobs. You know, for you, I mean, you grew up in New York. Like you said, your parents were artists. Your dad was an experimental filmmaker. Mm-hmm. You spent your life in L.A. as well, like doing television and other things. Where do you see yourself going? I mean, because you started as a filmmaker who was doing experimental stuff, not unlike your dad, and you've moved into a realm where now you've got a movie out with A24 that is in the theaters this week. I mean, do you see yourself moving in this direction, staying as Hollywood independent filmmaker?
My father's been making these films since the 50s, and he's making them to today, and he's never compromised in anything he's done. And that's an incredible thing to see in front of you. I also had the amazing fortune to have a older sister, 4 years older, that brought me in to see The Clash when I was 9. And I saw something really similar up on stage, and I saw something similar with my dad. I saw a certain honesty, but in that case, he was it was to a full adoring crowd, and I want to go somewhere in between those two. I think, you know, like that's the somewhere between my pop and strummer is what I would love to be.
That's good. That's a good place to be for all of us, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's just a goal. I mean, this is just a mark ahead. But I'm not saying it's where I'll be, but that's an intention. I want to keep making things that are different and surprising, and I'm hoping to be back here talking about something completely different.
Well, we'd love to have you. Filmmaker Azza Jacobs, the new film The Lover, starring Deborah Winger and Tracy Letts, in theaters now. Azza, thanks so much for stopping by being my guest at the big table.
Thank you. This has been great.
I never thought I'd miss you half as much as I do. And I never thought I'd feel this way, the way I feel about you.
Coming up, we're going to talk about the American Writers Museum, opening right here on Michigan Avenue. Donna Seaman's going to be in from Booklist. We'll talk to her. Preview what to expect from a new museum in Chicago. How cool is that? Also coming up, Chris Witaski is going to be with us. He is one of the stars of the Netflix show Love. It's a great show. They've got two seasons under their belt. I'm watching season two now, and they are filming season three.
Yeah, it's great news.
Yeah, it's a great show. Chris spent a couple years here in Chicago at Second City, at ETC. He's now out in Los Angeles doing the Hollywood thing, getting on shows like Love. You can also see him doing all sorts of stuff. He'll pop up on Jimmy Kimmel. He was in the Bob and David, the Mr. Show reunion for Netflix. So he's done a lot of stuff. We'll talk to him about his career and sort of what he learned while being in Chicago. He's from this area. I think he's from the suburbs. I think he grew up western suburbs. So talk to him a little bit about adjusting to life in Hollywood. Coming up at 10 o'clock, Chris Jones is going to join us, the chief theater critic for the Chicago Tribune. It's been a while since Chris has been on. We actually had him on for Martha Lavey's passing when he was in New York City, and that was very specific. But we haven't had a chance to sort of sit down, have a catch-all about what to watch, what should you take your mother to this weekend, what's coming up this summer, what can we expect from Broadway tryouts coming to town, and the big stuff, and also the Tony nominations.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That comes up, I think that's June that they do the Tonys.
I always like when I have seen a Tony Award-nominated show. Because then I have something to root for. For most years, that doesn't happen. I haven't seen anything unless it's like made a premiere here or something. But like I've actually seen a musical when I was in New York. I went to one of the musicals it was called Falsettos with the guy from Girls. What's his face? Andrew Rannells, who made his name in Book of Mormon. And I don't know. It was really good.
Yeah.
I will second that Tony nomination.
The nominations are out for War Paint, the show at Goodman.
Yeah.
Ebersol and Lupone both, I believe, got nominations. I don't think that the actual overall, the musical didn't get a nom, but the actors did. And some of the other parts, I was reading Chris's stuff. So we'll talk to him about that. It's been a while.
Yeah. I love him.
It's a big weekend, man. Mother's Day weekend. I'll tell you, the weather somehow switched on us. I looked at the app maybe 2 days ago, and I was like, it's going to be 60. Now it's going to be 70s, sunny.
Yeah.
Not to mention a couple of mid-80s coming up next week.
Ugh.
I mean, I could have been looking at Naples, Florida, or something different on my phone, but I think that's what it said. But this means for Download Nation that this will be the weekend that I start designing my little foyer garden.
Mmm.
For 2017. We should have had the Botanic Gardens in here this week to talk about what I should be doing. Because obviously, if you listen to the show with any sort of regularity, you know I have a serious problem. I did not shed a tear when that rabbit died on that United Airlines plane. Because me and the rabbits do not get along.
Mm-hmm.
I don't wish... I stop short of threatening them,
mm-hmm.
but I don't wish them well.
Yeah, okay.
That way. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So for me, this starts the week. I got to start thinking about it because I went up to... not too long ago, I was up at Gethsemane up in Andersonville.
Yeah, I love that place.
And I was asking about rabbits, and they said, oh, well, take a look. We got some spray over here. I'm like, do I look like a novice? I did the spray. I don't want the spray. There's got to be other ways. So I'm thinking about taking, you know, there's the Tabasco.
Mm-hmm.
You put Tabasco water and spray it on the plants. But I also remember some of the people who are calling in telling me to sort of put plastic stakes up so that the rabbits can't get at the stuff or don't find it hospitable. We planted echinacea, hoping they don't like that. We're going to put marigolds in. They don't like that.
Got it knocked.
Until they, but I just don't buy any of it. I just don't feel like any of it's going to work. Like I think what I'm going to have to do is sleep in the foyer. You know, sleep outside and just like make it as inhospitable as possible. I don't have anything against the rabbits. If you remember last year, a rabbit set up shop underneath my brush and had babies. And then as the babies got bigger, they just ate everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't stop them. I tried to stop them. I tried to move stuff around. I couldn't do it. So this year, after talking with the Botanic Gardens and other places, I'm like, you know, they gave me all these ideas. And now this is D-Day. I'm here. Deadline. Garden.
Is everything on the ground?
Yeah.
Would, if you made some sort of bed, like elevated bed, can they think, would they still be able to get into that?
Yeah, I don't know if that's possible, the way that the little...
Wait,
it's such
yard
a small
is yard.
It's,
yeah.
Such, it's not even a yard. That's why I said foyer. It's, I mean, it's just this little space,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I probably invest, I would probably say about $100, maybe more, in sort of getting the plants together and putting it all together, all the things you have to do to
yeah.
maintain a garden.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kind of feel at the end of the day, the rabbits, they're not paying. You know, and that's an investment that goes out the window. So I just get angry. I get angry that I have to go back to the Home Depot after it's already picked over.
Yeah.
Pick up the half purple plant. You know, half of it's not working. The other half is kind of purple. And you're like, I guess I'll take this. And then the rabbit eats it.
We have a commute. We're part of a community garden.
Right.
And it's not so much the animals. It's the humans taking stuff. You go there, like, you know, you see that your tomatoes are finally getting ripe. You go there to get them, and boom, somebody else has been watching
Somebody's
them, too.
Well, yours is 708 says, try encouraging hawks to hang out in your yard. That's super funny. A rubber snake or a fake owl. That's what 815 says. Wow, so we're getting, like... I like this. So I got to bring in some hawks, some fake owls, possibly a fake rubber. I do have a fake rubber snake. You just fake it? Do you think the rabbits are the rabbits that dumb that there's like a plastic snake that you'd get like from Target in the toy section? And they'd be like, I don't know, right?
Yeah.
They'd be like, oh, there's a snake. 219 says, where's your heart? Rabbits have to eat too. There's plenty going around. No. There's like, a big difference. There's plenty to eat. I live across from a park. They just want the good stuff.
Could you go, like, get some carrots or what have you, some other, you know, things that rabbits eat and put it like in your neighbor's yard and they would move over. They would come back. They'd
That's
go.
Not a bad idea.
They'd go there. Like, oh, well, let's get some more.
I don't
kids.
Know.
Every
I don't know why all the rabbits are in your yard.
Yeah.
708 says they will eat the plastic snake.
Getting conflicting stories.
773 says punk ass rabbits. I agree. Thank you, 773. How about getting a garden gnome owl? They're supposed to scare them away. I feel like. Human beings talking about what's going to scare a rabbit in a garden is futile, right? Like, the idea that we're like, oh, you know what's scary? That crazy gargoyle. The rabbit's like, that's a piece of stone. I cannot register it the way that you do. I don't know. I just want my little yard. That's it. I got a little seat out there to sit out there and be like, oh, and these rabbits, they just eat it. So.
Yeah, get the botanic garden in here.
I know. People are calling in. They want to tell me what to do. Maybe we could do it a little later, you know, in the show, because we got Donna's coming up here. We're going to talk about the American Writers Museum, Chris Witaski, but, you know, maybe after Chris Jones or something, we can talk about what I can do, because it's going down Saturday. Like, it's all up.
It's
Saturday.
Time, yeah.
And I see it. When I pull into my area and the headlights are on at night when we come home, 1 o'clock in the morning, it is, you see them scatter. They scatter in the back because there's a little courtyard in the back.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know they're just waiting. They're waiting for, they're like, oh, did you hear? It's almost, I can feel it. They're like pointing at the trajectory of the sun. And they're like, it's about time for that 1 yard to put in the impatience.
When I walk home, I walk down Granville for like a few blocks, and I see a bunch in the same spot every night.
Yeah, right.
And I, you know, I'm a friend to rabbits.
Oh, really?
You know, unlike you. And I say hi. I'm like, hi, oh, hi, little rabbit. How you doing?
Right.
And I need to walk on.
And they go, hey, man, you got any flowers? And they eat all your flowers. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, coming up on May 16th, Chicago's going to open a brand new museum. We've been talking about it all night. It's very exciting. The American Writers Museum will put centuries of American literature on display. Their 180 North Michigan Avenue space. The museum is something that's been in the works for years. It's the brainchild of an Irish businessman, Malcolm O'Hagan, who raised over $10 million to bring the museum to this country, to this city. It's the first of its kind. Joining me tonight, book list editor and author Donna Seaman. Donna's been involved with the museum from the beginning. She's on the National Advisory Council and the content leadership team for the museum, and she's got the preview. Donna, great to see you. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Justin. Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's talk about this. I mean, it's something, like I said, it's been in the works for years. Where does this come from? I mean, talk about the early days of getting involved with this.
Well, the early days were Malcolm O'Hagan, as you mentioned, an immigrant to this country, by the way, who had spent time in the Dublin Irish Writers Museum in Dublin. Hmm. Found that very inspiring, loves literature. Malcolm can quote Yeats at the drop of a hat. And he, as a new American, felt that this country was not recognizing the importance of writers in the very creation of our nation, which is based on words, you know,
right.
The Constitution.
Yeah, absolutely.
Declaration, Bill of Rights. So he started thinking about a writer's museum, and he started talking to people and more people and people at the National Endowment of the Arts, the Library of Congress. One of the many beautiful things about the American Writers Museum is how very many voices it includes, both past voices and present voices. And Malcolm really went for a group effort on this.
Well, that's the amazing part of it. And we'll talk about the building and we'll talk about what's in it. But the sort of collaboration or bringing together the past voices that you're going to honor, whether it be famous American writers, with the current and contemporary writers of today. It's not a museum in the sense that you walk in and it's going to be a bust of an American writer. You know, it's, of,
right.
You know, and everyone's going, oh, that's what that writer looked like. I mean, it's not that kind of museum. It's much more contemporary. It's much more interactive.
It is. It's a 21st century museum from start to finish, full of tradition. But the way the story is told is super active. It's not a library, for instance. You're not going to be surrounded by books. We have libraries. It's not a museum full of artifacts. It's a museum full of words and stories and images of authors and how they all connect. Like, it starts out with a giant map of the United States. You know, it's all this video electronic stuff. The programming is so sophisticated. It's just phenomenal. And so, you know, you can look at Mississippi and think William Faulkner, and you'll see where he actually lived and the imaginary places he created on this map. And the whole museum is like that. You can just look at things in passing, or you can get really immersed. And it's just beautifully designed and very welcome.
As an editor and an author yourself, were you surprised that there wasn't an institution like this already in the United States?
Yes. And, you know, you feel sort of foolish almost. I mean, I've been devoted to books forever and ever. And speaking to Malcolm, I went to some of the very early meetings. And I think we all were sitting there going, right, why has this not happened before? And yet it's a very complicated concept. What would be in a museum about right. American writers? So that was the big challenge of it and very exciting. And I think in part this was the right time for this idea because we can do so much electronically.
Well, before we get to what's in the museum, let's talk about why the museum is here in Chicago. I mean, because it could be any city. I would think New York City would be a prime contender, anywhere in the Eastern Seaboard, Boston, any more traditional sort of American colonial type towns.
Exactly.
Why does it end up here in Chicago?
Well, because Malcolm O'Hagan and Werner Hein, who became his partner in this, an attorney at Meyer Brown, talked to a lot of people about literature, thought a lot about where people go, an accessible place, a place that has a rich literary tradition that perhaps isn't as recognized nationally as it should be. I think they just fell in love with Chicago. And it's a great visitor place. It's also a place full of literary history, full of neighborhoods, beautiful architecture. You know, I love that it's in an old building, a vintage, right. beautiful building on Michigan Avenue. And I think they found here people that were super enthusiastic and open to it. There's so many museums crammed into Boston and New York and Washington, D.C. Chicago has great museums, too, but we can still grow. There's still a lot of potential here.
Well, let's talk about, I mean, there's the why it's in Chicago, but when we talk about it being at 180 North Michigan, you know, there's been a lot of sort of, I guess, consternation around where you put museums these days.
Yes.
We've seen that in Chicago in the last year or so.
Yes, exactly.
But talk about why 180 North Michigan. What was it about putting this American Writers Museum on Michigan Avenue?
Well, unlike certain museums who are not going to be in the city, the American Writers Museum realized that it really could use existing space because we didn't need huge space and we didn't need to erect something. We could use an existing building that is in a historic part of the city. You know, Michigan Avenue, everyone knows how to get to Michigan Avenue. It's just a little north of Millennium Park and the Great Art Institute of Chicago and the Cultural Center as well, which will be
right.
kind
it
of a
big
partner
part
of,
it. Yeah,
of the
right.
museum. So there's a good connection between those two, readily accessible, and yet, you know, sort of a surprise place. It's on the second floor, and you go up there and you feel very sequestered and immersed in this other world, and it's intimate. It feels large. People that have been to it have said to me they immediately realize they would have to come back.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there's a real coziness to it because it's in a building that's already there. And it's, you know, just like a lot of the great old towers downtown Chicago, they're just full of surprises.
Well, Blair Kamen in the Chicago Tribune given a stellar review just in terms of architecture. We'll talk about what's in the museum. Let's take a quick break. Donna Seaman is my guest tonight, book list editor and author herself on the National Advisory Council and the Content Leadership Team for the American Writers Museum, which is at 180 North Michigan. It's going to open next week, a brand new museum here in Chicago. I love it. Donna Seaman, my guest, we'll take a quick break. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Brand new museum we're talking about at the American Writers Museum. It's going to be at 180 North Michigan starting on May 16th. We had just sort of a press preview this week. Some people got in. Joining me tonight, book list editor and author Donna Seaman. She's been involved since the beginning. She's on the National Advisory Council, the content leadership team for the museum. And we're talking about let's talk about what's in it. I guess the first question I have is just this. There's a lot of literature to choose from. You know, this is really shaping up when you think about it to be almost like a Hall of Fame in the way that you're celebrating American writers. How do you make that choice? What's the criteria?
Oh, it was so tough, Justin. There are so many American writers. And we were defining writing very broadly, speeches, plays, poetry, novels, history. There's even some advertising in there, screenplays. So it was an enormous task to try and be selective and find representative authors. I mean, obviously, some writers absolutely have to be there. You would never not have Herman Melville in there, or Emily Dickinson, or Ernest Hemingway, or Nelson Algren, because we're in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
But there were so many writers. So we really looked at writers that were significant, both artistically, but also their influence, their voices. You know, American literature is a real story of being heard, of different people insisting on being brought into the conversation.
Right.
Because at the beginning, it was restricted. It was all men, for instance. It was all white people. So the evolution of American society was propelled in many ways by American literature, by writing, by writers who sat down and wrote and said, you will listen to me. I have things to say.
And I mean, we talked about this. It's not necessarily all traditional. And you just mentioned all the different disciplines that will be on display. But when I talk about traditional, it's not just anyone who, you know, was a classic piece of literature you read in high school. I mean, you're talking about contemporary works, people who are writing right now.
Well, in the museum, we have a wall of 100 writers, and they are all deceased.
Okay.
So today's writers will be in the museum.
When they die.
No, well, yes, but also as writers
right.
present. There's tons of programming. You know, we have a space for readings and workshops, and so.
Well, that too is, I mean, it's such a fluent thing when you think about it. There's so much programs. There's exhibits that'll come up. I'm assuming that you'll have other opportunities to showcase writers who may not have made the cut or did, and you just want to make more out of their work, right?
Exactly. There'll be many programs. There's two small galleries that will be temporary exhibits. Right now, we have Jack Kerouac's scroll for On the Road in there,
wow.
which is an amazing artifact, an amazing bit of American history. And another exhibit called Palm, which is an art installation, a tribute to the poet W.S. Merwin, who lives in Hawaii and raises palm trees and is a master gardener and very concerned with the environment, and a nature poet, too. So there'll be different exhibits in those two galleries throughout. And that will introduce people to writers and new ways of perceiving them and thinking about them.
I think about, and having the conversation about not how this country's not had a museum. And I think about the role of the library. And I think in Chicago of the Harold Washington Library, instance, a huge building that has not only a place for reference, but a community center and also a place that can really reflect and showcase the community, that in this case it's Chicago. Where does the museum pick up where a library like that, which really does serve almost like a museum, leave off?
Well, it's very interesting juxtaposition, because in the Harold Washington Library, which is a magnificent institution, there's all kinds of books and literature and other materials. So it's very broad and international, global. So the American Writers Museum focuses not on the books so much, but on the writers' lives. It's focused on American writers, going back to the earliest possible days that we could think of for storytelling in America. And it's sort of creates sort of a constellation of writers. So it's a very distilled and very specific way of looking at American literature, whereas in a great grand library like Charles Washington Library, you have everything.
Yeah, everything, right. It's reference everything. Points yeah. and things. Yeah. So I take it how to build paper airplanes won't make it into the American Writers Museum.
Probably not.
when we think about the museum and here being in Chicago, as you guys talked about why it was located here, Chicago does have a very rich literary history, and it is one that it's a little bit more subdued than sort of the New York cities of the world, but Chicago has a huge connection to American literature.
Oh, profoundly so. In fact, this year in June, we will be celebrating the centennial of Gwendolyn Brooks, the great poet based in Chicago her entire life, tremendously influential the world over. Of course, we have Studs Terkel here. We had Nelson Algren, as we mentioned. Ernest Hemingway, we claim, is a Chicago writer. I mean, and there is a Chicago exhibit in the museum that's really wonderfully done. And it pays tribute to Richard Wright, and, the list goes on and on.
It really does. A lot of men there.
Yes.
But I mean, when you think about
Edna Ferber, I can think of some women, Jane Addams.
Jane Addams, right. Yeah, I mean, when you think about the significant contributions this city has had to the overall landscape that is American literature, it is pretty striking. All those names that you mentioned, even though we're in Chicago, we may be biased because we know them, but they are national names that people who are fans of the history of American literature celebrate.
Absolutely. And, tremendously influential. I mean, Chicago, it was such a hub. I mean, so many people came here in the Great Migration. It's such an industrial center, a railroad center, and all that you find in Chicago literature and American literature as a whole.
Donna, how's it feel? Here we are. May 16th is when this thing opens. That's next week, and you've been working on this for almost a decade. How does it feel to have the American Writers Museum open its doors?
It was really overwhelming. I went to a preview for, you know, donors and other people that were involved Friday night, and I was kind of speechless. And these were long, long conversations and tons of writing and research and, you know, all very abstract, really. And to walk into an actual place and see actual exhibits and writers, I was so moved. I really was. I still feel I tear up when I think about it.
The American Writers Museum, putting centuries of American literature on display at 180 North Michigan. It's going to open next week, May 16th, to the public. In studio tonight, booklist editor and author Donna Seaman. She is on the National Advisory Council for the museum, the content leadership team. She's been with the project since the beginning. Donna, congratulations, and we look forward to checking out what this new museum has to offer.
Thank you so much, Justin. What a pleasure.
That's fun. New museum. It's a whole kids section. She was like, oh, we didn't talk about the kids section. We'll talk about it next time. And I was just saying, like, I have a 9-year-old. Projects, you know? You can go over there, you can check it out. I'm excited about it. 180 North Michigan. There we go. A new museum. I've been saying for the last year, we just need a new museum. You know, if it's not a literature museum, I just hope it's a museum about movies, you know, specific science fiction movies. And I don't care where they build it. They just build it on the lake.
As long as it's not taking up a lot of South Side green space.
Yeah,
like in a 3-building sort of configuration.
I just feel, you know, build it now and worry about that stuff later. All right, coming up, Chris Witaski, one of the stars of Netflix's Love, is going to join us, former Second City ETC star who moved out to California. Also, you see him on sketches. He was in the Bob and David, the Mr. Show reunion for Netflix, and he also toured with them. I was at the Vic Theater to see that show, that Mr. Show reunion, and there's Witaski up there. You know, they always have, like, the guys behind him, the guys who essentially have one line and move the chair. That was Chris. So we'll talk with him about his success coming up here after the news. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, if you're not watching the Netflix romantic comedy Love, starring Paul Rudd and Gillian Jacobs and produced by Judd Apatow, well, you should. It's a really well-written and directed show about trying to find love in Los Angeles. It's great to watch for the comedy, but it's also great because we get to see some Chicago talent in the series, namely Chris Witaski. Chris spent a few years making us laugh at Second City, starring in a couple Second City ETC reviews before moving to Los Angeles. Since that time, we've seen him on the Netflix return of Bob and David, on Jimmy Kimmel. He also hosts a live talk show from the UCB Theater where he interviews big names in comedy, the show called So You Do Comedy, which is aptly named. The show Love is in its second season on Netflix, and they're shooting a third season now, and it's my pleasure to welcome Chris Witaski to the Download. Chris, thanks for being here. We appreciate it.
Buddy, it's been too long, and thanks for having me.
So, I mean, let's talk about Love first. I mean, how did you get involved with this show? Because this is obviously a lot of great L.A. talent, and we had Paul on the show at one point, but how did you get involved with it?
Well, I was very lucky for a couple reasons. Number one was that the woman who cast the show is a lady by the name of Allison Jones, mm-hmm. who, if you probably don't know who she is, but if you were to type her name into IMDb, you would see that she has been the casting director of just about every big comedy in the last, like, 12 years.
She did The Office. She did things like that, right?
The Office, Parks and Rec, Curb Your Enthusiasm, Arrested Development, and then big movies like Bridesmaids and Knocked Up. And yeah, so she's been behind a lot of stuff. So anyway, she came to see me perform at Second City when I was still on stage there at, on the ETC. So she saw me do my thing in Chicago. And so then when I auditioned for her for Love a couple years later, she remembered me and knew what I could do. And so she was a big help in getting me on the show.
How often does that happen, Chris, like where casting directors and producers and people in Hollywood actually come to Second City in Chicago to see you, and then you run into them again when you actually get out there in Los Angeles?
You know, not as often as you would think. And the smart casting directors are the ones who go out into the world and go to Chicago and New York and other places to try to find talent, as opposed to just sitting in LA, you know, hoping the talent comes to them. And so I think the only people I remember really coming when I was on stage was her and then Lorne Michaels from SNL.
It's interesting to me that, you know, the Chicago connection in LA and New York is so strong. I mean, we've had so many people on the show. I mean, from Brad Morris to Keegan-Michael Key. I mean, people who are Second City, true blue Chicago people who are doing so well right now. What do you draw from the crew that you know out there, the people that you improvised with, the people that you came up with in Chicago? Do you guys still hang out? Do you draw from each other? Do you inspire each other to and also work together?
Oh, all of that. And it's, you know, I grew up outside of Chicago. I grew up in St. Charles. So I'm a Midwest guy. And moving to Los Angeles is a very strange experience. It's not, Los Angeles is a completely different world than I was used to coming from the Midwest. So the coolest thing that happens is all my Second City buddies and my Annoyance Theater buddies and my IO Theater buddies, they all move out here too. They either move here or New York, and a lot of them moved out here. So it was great to kind of have a built-in community when I first got here. And we still hang out constantly and start projects together and do improv shows together. And so that has really been kind of a saving grace for a lot of us who move out here.
You know, for you as an actor and a writer, but as an actor, you have a lot of more options in this golden age of television with the streaming show services like Amazon, Hulu, or Netflix than an actor like yourself from Second City 10, 15 years ago, who just go out and try to get network sitcoms. Talk about that. Talk about how, you know, the proliferation of, you know, the network television show has helped you or hurt you in terms of trying to get work.
Well, it's really helped me a lot. And, you know, I think that there's good and bad to it. I think that it definitely gives a lot more actors opportunity to be on shows because there's so many. But then the problem is, you know, you don't have a show like Seinfeld anymore where everybody watches it, you know? Now there's these little niche shows where people, you know, tune in if they can or check it out here and there. But, I mean, it used to be that there was one big show and everybody watched it. Now there's like thousands, and I feel like I can't catch up. I mean, every day somebody's telling me about some new show that I have to check out. I'm like, I only have so much time in the day. So then I get overwhelmed, and so then I end up watching just like, you know, Chopped or Living in Alaska.
Well, you know, it's got to help, though. I mean, in a successful show like Love, where you are a streaming show on Netflix and, you know, it's a show that features a lot of comedians who are in L.A. and New York, but maybe not the biggest name recognition. But it helps that Netflix has actually ordered two seasons and a third one is on the way. It's becoming sort of a staple to continue to watch this show for people who keep coming back to the service.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's definitely – and they even write the show with that in mind. Like, they create it purposely to be bingeable. And so they have that in mind, that people are not going to be watching this once a week. They're going to be sitting down and watching this whole thing in, you know, 3 hours. And then, you know, the other big thing we have is the executive producer is this guy, Judd Apatow, who has this Midas touch, who was behind, you know, Girls on HBO and then tons of movies and Amy Schumer's movie. And now that he's got a new show on HBO called Crashing. And so having Judd behind this, I think, really is what kind of helped, you know, Netflix to buy two seasons right out of the gate and help them to renew it, because they know that, you know, he knows what he's doing by now and he's going to deliver a good product.
You know, for you to be, I mean, somewhat a newbie out in L.A., you've been out there for a couple of years now, but to come from Chicago, like you said, growing up in St. Charles, being a staple at Second City on the ETC stage, to go out and to become a part of this ensemble that includes people like Gillian Jacobs and Judd Apatow, executive producer, even Paul Rust, who's done so much, including writing the Pee-wee movies. How does it help you as a comedian to be around an ensemble of comedians and actors and writers who all are making their name?
So much. I mean, you know, so I've been out here for 3 years now, and somebody was saying the other day, the first 3 years in L.A., you're planting seeds that you hope will then grow in 3 or 4 years. And right now it's starting to feel like some of the seeds that I've been planting are starting to grow. And just to be around these other creative people who are also wanting to, you know, take it to the next level, it really helps a lot. And then getting to meet somebody like Judd, who then, you know, sees what I can do and sees that I'm good at improvising on set and making things funnier. It just, you know, doors start opening and you start meeting new people, and then you hope that it snowballs. Yeah. So that's, you know, where I'm at right now.
Chris Pataky, my guest here on The Download tonight, he's in the show Love, which is in season 2 right now on Netflix. Season 3, they're shooting as we speak. All right, let me ask you about, you know, you mentioned about improvising on set. This is something that we just talked to Scott Adsit about, the same thing. This concept that at one point, someone coming out of Chicago at I.O., at Second City, at Annoyance, like you mentioned, you would have a leg up on everybody. Because you come out with a certain, you'd have the chops of being able to improvise, to do things on set. And you saw more and more directors being like, more of that, more of that. And now it's become, you know, everybody who comes to L.A. has to have improv. You know, it becomes a skill. You know, right. I could play bass. I could play racquetball. It's at the bottom of the resume. Talk about, I mean, is it harder for you as an improviser to stand out, knowing that everybody who, every actor, every Tom, Dick, and Harry that comes to L.A. has tried to do the same?
That is a good question. And yes, but also I think that, you know, people will take a couple improv classes and then they'll put improv on their right. on their resume. But you really don't see if somebody's a good improviser until you're on set and in the heat of the moment, and it's nerve wracking. And they, the director says, okay, now improvise a take. And that's when you really, I think, that's when I really am able to show what I've been studying for the last, since I was 13 years old, when I took my first class at Second City. That's when I'm really able to, I think, show, okay, I know what I'm doing here and I'm going to prove it to you. You know, the talent kind of rises to the top. So it's a good question, but I still think that if you're really good at it, it shows.
You don't even think about the pressure of a director being like, all right, next one, let's improvise, go. And everybody on set just kind of watching you. They can't laugh. They can't give you any energy. You just have to sort of make it up as you go with a scene partner that you may not have worked with before. I mean, there's a lot that goes into doing a make them up on the set like that.
It's extremely nerve-wracking. I remember the first table read I ever did. You know, they told us have fun with the lines. And so I'm sitting there nervous and we're all waiting for Judd to get there. And then all of a sudden he walks in, and out of all the seats he could have sat in, he chose the seat directly in front of me. And so he sits down, he's like 2 feet in front of me. And I've met the guy, you know, a couple times at this point. I mean, extremely nerve wracking.
Did you do well? I hope you did well. Well, obviously you did. You're in year 3 of the
I think I did well. I think I was able to use all that experience I got from Second City and all those times when, you know, Lorne Michaels was sitting in the audience to, you know, kind of overcome the anxiety.
You know, before I let you go, I mean, you did the Bob and David reboot, which was awesome. You went on tour with them, saw that show at the Vic. You've done a lot with UCB, but you're now doing the talk show on stage, So You Do Comedy. And you're getting great guests to come out and talk with. I mean, do you feel like the names that were thrown around this interview, from Judd Apatow to Bob and David to the people that have been on your show, Andy Richter and Fred Willard, all the way down the line. I mean, do you feel like you're creating a community in Los Angeles, becoming part of something special?
Yeah, it does feel like that. You know, the cool thing about living out here is that there's a lot more access to, you know, people. And so in Chicago, you know, I could interview Mick Napier or Andrew Alexander, but then, you know, not a lot of people live in Chicago. But out here, you know, it's like an embarrassment of riches. So I can, you know, reach out to somebody and say, hey, what are you doing on Monday night? Do you want to come to do my interview show? And a lot of the time these people say yes, because they're looking for stuff to do. So, you know, I always say out here, it's not a theater town like Chicago is. And there have been times where I have a huge interview guest for my show. It's once a month at UCB, and I'm still struggling to sell tickets. And I always say to my fiance, if I was doing this show in Chicago, it would sell out in 2 minutes. Yep. There'd be a line around the block. But out here, I mean, when you see celebrities at the grocery store, it's like not as big of a deal.
There you go. You should do a talk show in the grocery store. That might be what you need to do.
Maybe that's the key.
Chris Witaski, a longtime Second City stalwart. He was on stage at the ETC. He is now starring in the show Love with Paul Rust and Gillian Jacobs, executive producer Judd Apatow, which can be found on Netflix, season 1 and 2. 2 just came out. 3 is taping right now. Chris, a pleasure to catch up with you. Congrats on the success early in your career, and we hope to talk to you soon.
You too, buddy. Great talking to you.
Coming up, Chris Jones, chief theater critic, writer for the Chicago Tribune. We got a couple things to talk about. Talk about the Tony nominations. We could talk about the summer season. I love the piece you guys did about there's like a million people going to be looking for theater suggestions for Mother's Day weekend.
Yeah.
But there's a lot going on. We could talk about it. We got a lot to talk about.
So. I did throw in that Tracy Letts play, which is basically about a middle-aged divorcee. And after I wrote that, I'm like, did I really recommend that for Mother's Day? Probably not the best. Heck of a Mother's Day.
Letts is getting some good plays. He was in the Lovers we talked about.
He's not really a Mother's Day figure, though,
is he? All right, so let's see here. I want to read some of these quotes or read some of these texts that came in, right?
Yeah.
These are texts helping me with my rabbit problem.
What's you have a rabbit problem? Yeah. Too many rabbits.
You know, man, I got one. And it's so fun. The reason I wanted to read it is because there's so many great WGN listeners who live in areas that are like they have yards, and I always forget to explain to people they don't have a yard. I have a space, and so it makes it even more frustrating when you go and spend money at the Home Depot to put a flower in.
I mean, they don't even have a Home Depot close. No, right? You got to get in the car.
Yeah. In my case, you know, you go get the flower, you put it in, and then the rabbit eats the one flower. You know, and all I'm trying to do is figure out how do I keep with. And last year, I remember this because someone texted in. They said, "Oh, you know what? You should get this spray. You can get it at the garden store. Coyote urine, right? That's essentially
coyote urine."
But I did this. If you remember this, Pete, I did this at one point where we sprayed the stuff, and it's got a smell to it, and you're like, oh, this kind of ruins the experience of sitting out here. And then secondly, it attracted flies, like at the hundreds. So flies just came out and just were like on the leaves. And you're like, well, that doesn't, no, I'm not looking to replace rabbits with flies.
You see a rabbit as a pest or a sweet thing?
I see it
you
as a pest.
You hate rabbits. You don't see any aesthetic value.
Pete loves the little rabbit, and he was just saying he goes and talks to him on the corner. I used to. I didn't care, but they're the bane of my existence right now. How about getting a 773 says a Tyrannosaurus Rex statue, like the one in Jurassic Park.
Would that fool a rabbit?
There's a ton of, like, get a fake coyote. Keep it away from it'll keep away all the geese and goose poop. I don't have a geese problem. And then they go to the hardware store and get the animal urine. This is a perfect example. 847. You can also purchase animal urine at the hardware store, and that'll keep the animals out of your crops.
Your crops?
It's not crops. It's two flowers. I am a very simple gardener. I'm trying, man. I'm trying. I'm just trying to, like, get into something new, and I love the serenity of it. But they're not crops.
You got a ceramic pot, is what you got.
I got a hydrangea, right? And I'm hoping it comes back. Let's see what else. That's what 630 says. Pete, you're on to what we do. We throw at night. Throw at night over the 6-foot fence in the neighbor's yard. So I think they're talking about just throw it on somebody else. Like, dude, put this up.
If we can catch it.
Yeah. An organic plastic snake. They'll eat it.
Organic plastic?
I'm telling you, Chris, there's like, I can't even explain. Like, so for what I've heard tonight is animal urine or fake predators, like plastic predators that you like stake in the yard, which I think would be weird. You're walking past my house and goes, why does that guy have a fake coyote? Right?
That, scare a small child.
Dude, just put something out there. Check it out. See if it works. But like one of your kids' toys that isn't used anymore.
Like I do have like this kind of, I know we have this like rubber snake, so maybe I'll put it out there and see if it does anything.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, thanks. All right, Chris Jones coming up here after the news. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Chris Jones in studio, chief theater critic over at Chicago Tribune.
Howdy, howdy.
Wow, good to see you, buddy.
Always good to be here.
All right, so let's talk about this. It feels like there's thousands of plays just for this weekend for Mother's Day. I guess I never recognized that this is a big theater weekend or a big theater holiday.
Well, some of it is we've got these couple of long-running shows in town. So we've got Aladdin there at the Cadillac Palace. The Caddy Palace, as we like to call it.
Sure.
That's there through September. So that's there. I like it. It's for the kids, really. It's Disney, and it's a tour, but it's a fresh tour, and it's full on, you know, it's the full Monty. It's very spectacular. You can see your money on the stage, which I always say
that's
is
good.
Always good.
That's good.
Always good. They take your money. It's good when you can see it. So you see your money on the stage. It's fast moving. It's fun. It's actually a better cast than the one in New York, I thought. So I like that. For the kids. For the kids.
For the kids.
For the kids. So that's A, option A. Option B is Hamilton. You know, good luck. Still almost impossible to get a ticket. Daniel Breaker now playing Aaron Burr. Still almost impossible to get a ticket. And that's going to be here a long time. So if you haven't got one, just relax for a bit. That's what I say about that. Then you've got Rent over this weekend at the Oriental. Sadly, a non-equity tour. They're all clutching their new BFAs in hand. And every bio reads First National Tour.
So you can even do that, a non-equity tour?
You can do that. You can do that. People don't know. And, of course, they charge the same amount of money.
I
always make it my mission to point it out.
Of course. I mean, it's a touring show, right?
Yeah.
It's downtown Chicago. You'd
downtown
think that would be equity, right?
You would think that. And, you know, and in fairness to these young guys, they're not bad. I mean, they're very good singers. But it's, you know, when it gets to the sort of the emotional part of Rent, it's trickier when you
don't have a lot
of
experience. Does that show hold up? This 20-year anniversary,
right? I know one thing. You cannot get a seat this weekend. I was messing around on Ticketmaster because I was just thinking, how much are they charging for this? And it's pretty much sold out. It's gone clean all weekend. I think Rent just means a lot to a lot of people. It's got a title that, I mean, it's a fantastic score. One of the greatest scores ever written for the musical theater by Jonathan Larson, who died. Horrible loss. It's really a remarkable piece. I just, you know, I've seen it a billion times.
And I was going to say, it's a show that shows up in colleges.
Yes.
It shows up in off
very
off
much
loop.
Like the ones right here.
But I mean, in a good way. It's just really well. It's oft produced.
It's oft produced.
So what makes? I'm surprised to hear that the audience is clamoring to see it again. But it's a 20th anniversary, so I can understand.
Well, that's I'm always fascinated in show business by when you do your big project, Justin. You got to remember, the title is everything. Mm-hmm. I always say, greatest title ever. There's two titles that are really good. There's a play by Laura Eason that was here, and she called it Sex with Strangers. Sex with Strangers. Just the title. It's not really about sex with strangers. Yeah, it just has the title.
Right, right.
Everybody, most produced play in 2014. And the other one that I always really liked is this crappy little show called I Love You, You're Perfect, Now Change.
Right, I remember that.
Everybody's in a relationship who is convinced that the other person is trying to change them. So it's all in the title. So
the title would be Say It Isn't So, a musical based on and inspired by the music of Hall & Oates.
Very good.
Right? Done. Let's make it happen, finally.
Or maybe just Rabbit, Where's My Geranium?
I'm going to get you, Rabbit.
I'm going to get you, Rabbit.
That's
I'm going to get you, Rabbit.
A musical about my... So, two plans. Anyway, go ahead.
They call it the 20th anniversary tour, and they can add another $20 on the ticket price. So that's what's going on.
Yeah.
If you like Rent, you'll be fine. If you like,
so those are all the downtown.
Got all that. Wait, not done. Not done. My Fair Lady still at the Lyric Opera, still going strong.
I saw that. That was good.
Yeah, it was fine.
Richard E. Grant was on the show. Yeah,
a little on the dull side, I thought, but
I got to ask you about this.
Yes,
because we talked to Richard Grant about it, and it was interesting. I saw it because I wanted to see
it.
The show.
Yes,
I saw the musical. Before the interview, so I did it during the day, and I saw it with the high school groups.
Oh.
Right?
Lovely.
So the high school kids go to the Lyric to see My Fair Lady.
Yes.
There's a point in the musical, the famed musical, where Eliza storms out, says it's over, and
yes.
walks out at the end. The crowd almost gets on their feet screaming and cheering
yeah.
that Henry Higgins got his. And it was not a normal kind of response because, you know, it's a kind of misogynistic musical from 1956. And
yes.
We get the whole concept. And I'm old enough to know, well, it was a different time when this was written.
Yeah, and it was, it was based on Shaw, who in his way, was trying to be a
right.
progressive ultimately.
Right.
And he was trying to sort of undermine the British.
These kids, man, these 15, 16-year-old
like,
kids are like, no, this is not happening
not
in my generation.
Not happening. It totally changed.
And Richard E. Grant kind of talked about the idea that was kind of the first time he's ever experienced that with My Fair
yes.
Lady. I mean, they were mad. They were like mad, like he was the villain.
Well, you know, the issue with that show is you've got to, in My Fair Lady, you've got to know what Eliza's getting out of it. Like, otherwise, the whole show really is a misogynist show. So I always think to myself, you know, in the ideal My Fair Lady, Henry Higgins got to be hot, got to be charming, mm-hmm. got to have a sparkle in his eye, got to be generous. You know, you've got to know what she is getting. Then I think that's one of the crucial things whenever you're doing that show. And it's interesting because these musicals, they do change over time and they get harder to play, as you point out, especially with the young generation.
Yeah, I just wonder, I don't know, you know, many more about the American standards, and I wonder how much that plays out where sort of, stereotypical or through lines that don't play anymore socially.
Well, the problem is that some of these shows have some of the greatest songs ever written,
of course,
including My Fair Lady, and that's not the only one. So there's a load of titles that you go, the songs are great, but I've got to sit through that misogynistic book in order to get to the next song.
That's the title. The songs are great. ..
But that's very difficult. And then you've got that little tent. You've been to that little tent there at Soldier Field with the GGs, the Cavalier.
I feel like I'm the only one who hasn't.
You've not been?
I have not.
The posters say it's the greatest show of
best
all
show
time.
Ever.
Best show ever.
Best show ever. No quotes on that, by the way.
My kids were walking by. They're like, Dad, it's the best show ever. I said, uh-huh.
I'm surprised on that one that they could say
best
that.
Show ever.
The best show ever.
Just that. That's just... Say it like that.
Yeah, I guess
Let's
so.
Just say it like that. I had this experience. I reviewed this terrible Broadway show, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Terrible, terrible show. One of the worst Broadway shows of the year. And they cobbled together a quote of mine where it would be me like saying, this is the most horrifically, worst. And they literally, I can't think of the exact way, but they literally created a sentence where it was one word from it to make it look like it was a positive review.
Dot, dot, dot.
It was the most outrageous. The horse show, I believe you use there's like a Mother's Day thing. If you want 25% off, you heard it on WGN. I think you use the promo code MOTHER. You can get like a free ticket this Mother's Day weekend.
Oh, really?
And if your mom likes horses, it's a nice...
It seems to play. I mean, they seem to have gotten... I mean, it seems to be a show that's well talked about.
Well talked about.
Yeah.
You just got to like the horse. The great thing about the horse is the horse can stand... Unlike a circus where, you got to have a trainer. In the horse show, the lights can come up and you just see 30 horses. Charming. It's bucolic.
You see
a little rabbit going around the side, too.
So those are all the downtown.
Cavalier, those are all the big downtown.
So
shows.
are there stuff in the off loops? Let's take a break because I stay on time here, and we'll come back and talk
all
about
right.
the stuff that you can see this weekend that's not just the downtown fair. Chris Jones, chief theater critic over at the Chicago Tribune, over at Next Door.
Next Door.
Stay with us. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Chris Jones, chief theater critic in studio tonight. We're talking about some of the Mother's Day Fair. We talked about the loop stuff. There's
yeah.
a lot of big shows.
Big shows in the loop.
Is there anything outside of Randolph Street and a tent at Soldier Field that we should be paying attention to?
Well, if you don't want to come downtown, you've got two good musicals going in the burbs. You've got Jesus Christ Superstar, soon to be NBC Live, out there at the beautiful Paramount Theater in Aurora with an all African American cast, doing a kind of, let's just say that the score is embellished. It's really a very different vocal interpretation, and I found it like totally fresh and fun, and it's great. It's kind of a gospel Jesus Christ Superstar. They certainly, I mean, the tempos are different. Many of the songs, many of the singers are fantastic. It's like a national cast. It's very, very good. A lot of fun, if Jesus Christ Superstar can be said to be fun. But it is kind of a good time.
That's always, that, I always thought it was fun.
Yeah.
And Judas, what are you doing?
And this one is like, I don't know how to love it. What can you say? And then down at the beautiful, at the Drury Lane, Oak Brook, or as we say in the trade, the Dreary Lane, there is Chicago the Musical. Now, you know, that's an interesting history behind that, because there was this production on Broadway still running, right? This is Chicago's hometown story based on, you know, a woman who worked in this very building, who all of the, you know, the murders in the show were real. They all really happened. She just pulled it out of her reporter's notebook, Maureen Dallas Watkins, who wrote it. But it's not been done here in like 20 years, because this tour and that Broadway show has wrapped up the rights. So this is the first locally produced Chicago in a long time. And the guy out there at Oak Brook, Bill Ostertag, was telling me, you know, he called every week to say, is it available? They go, no, it's not available. Call next week. And next week he would call again. Finally, the guy wore the guys down so much, they're like, just do
that's
it.
How, that's
just
how it works,
do
right?
The show. Do the show. And so it's got a whole, you know, it's a lot of fun. It's got Ife Butler as Mama Morton, which is my favorite part of it. And it's a lot of fun. And, you know, it's just kind of nice to sit there and see local people do that. So that's kind of cool. Yeah. I kind of like that.
You want to hear something?
Yeah, come on. Yeah. Here we go.
This and is... now, ladies and gentlemen, the keeper
good
of
number.
The keys, the countess of
this
the
This is
clip,
a Mother's Day special for all your listeners.
The mistress of Murderer's Row, matron Mama Morton.
There it comes. These are words to live by, Justin.
Ask any of the chickies in my pen. They'll tell you I'm the biggest mother hen. I love them all and all of them love me.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's good stuff.
Hang on one sec. Wait for the chorus. Here we go.
System called
just this next one. Okay, coming up is the rule at my house. Golden rule.
Got a little motto. Always sees me.
Here it comes.
When you're good to mama, mama's good to you.
Oh, yes.
There it is.
That's the truth.
It's hard to believe that
that's
it hasn't
Day
been
special.
Done. That's an interesting story. I would think that Chicago be done all the time.
Yeah.
Chicago.
Yeah, it makes a lot of money for the people who stop it from being done. So that's kind of where we're at with that.
You know, I think about Chicago or Jesus Christ Superstar or My Fair Lady. I mean, and Rent, we just mentioned about.
Yeah.
I mean, these are classic musicals that come through Chicago, Chicago notwithstanding. That seems like all the time.
Yes.
Like, it's this idea, like, and I know that I even, like, I think there's there was another play I saw that's coming this summer, a musical, that I'm like, didn't they just do that? King and I.
Yes.
King and I's coming back.
Coming
and I'm
back
like,
the summer, yeah.
And I just, I wonder, because I'll watch the Tonys, and the Tonys will say best new musical, this, that, and the other, and there's new musicals, things like that. Are we not just, besides Hamilton and maybe Book of Mormon, are we just not interested in those new?
Well, I think it takes time. I think it takes time for a title to sink into the popular consciousness. It used to be that they would trot out these shows very quickly. Somebody like you or I would be like, oh, great, that hot new thing from Broadway. But they found they make more money, frankly, if they let the shows settle. You know, you let the Tonys happen, you do all the TV, you do all the media. And then eventually people, you know, really come to know these titles. It's that, you know, they call it in the business pre-awareness. People, it's very difficult to get somebody to buy an entertainment product that they know nothing about. They just, even if they've been told it's good, it's like if they know nothing about it, it's very, very difficult.
Is this the, I think it's this summer, Something Rotten's coming through.
Yeah, that's a fun show.
But I mean, will we see, I just think about it because Hamilton, of course, last year just swept the Tonys.
Right.
We're going to talk, we'll take a break here, but we'll talk about what's up this year in the Tonys. I mean, will we see those? I want to see. I'm in Chicago. I want to see those plays.
All right.
I want to see those musicals.
I
right?
will assess when you will get to see them. If you will get to see
Chris
them.
Jones, chief theater critic for the Tribune, in studio tonight. We'll take a break. We'll come back. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Chris Jones from the Chicago Tribune, chief theater critic in studio. We're talking theater. It's been a while since we've talked, so we got a lot to catch up on. The Tony nominations.
Tony.
A triple Tony. All right. So let's talk about. First off, let's talk about the Chicago shows that got nominations, because the only ones I really saw, and you'll probably correct me here, but was the actresses for War Paint.
Yeah, so War Paint. So if we look at the musicals, so you've got your new musicals. You have War Paint, which was here at the Goodman Theater. It's about, Helena Rubinstein, Estee Lauder, Patti LuPone, and Christine Ebersole. And they got nominations, the two divas in the show, but not the actual show. And they're up against Bette Midler in Hello, Dolly, and that's a tough.
What
assignment.
Does that mean for? We talked a lot about War Paint going from the Goodman and going to Broadway, and whether or not it's going to be successful.
Yeah.
If it doesn't get a nomination from the Tonys for overall show, does that make it not
well,
a success?
Well, it's not ideal. You would want to be nominated. Any new musical wants to be nominated for a Tony. It is worse to get blanked entirely, like the show Amelie, for example. It's closed. I think it closed last weekend or this week. No, next week. That got nothing. Nothing. So that's gone, baby. Just gone.
How is War Paint doing on Broadway?
It's fine as long as those two women are in it. I mean, that's the reality of it. It's everybody.
They're Broadway stars.
Right. It's a perfectly okay show. It's not a great show, but it's a perfectly okay show. And for the fans of those two great actresses, and for, a lot of women of a certain age on the Upper East Side who are interested in, remember, Helena Rubinstein and Estee Lauder, they're interested in it. So I think that's okay.
Is that the extent of the Chicago representation this year?
Elizabeth Arden, I just said Estee Lauder. Elizabeth Arden, I correct myself. Elizabeth Arden, Helena Rubinstein, yeah. So that's okay. The Tony is really between... I would say two shows. One is Dear Evan Hansen, which is a sort of a musical about a teenager, a sort of misfit teenager, 17-year-old. It's a very lovely show. It's about social media and teens,
about that tonight.
They're really making an attempt to talk about how social media blows everything out of proportion these days. And it has a wonderful performance from Ben Platt, who was here actually in Chicago in Book of Mormon Book of Mormon. You probably saw him. Really, really good. He played the funny sidekick and Elder Cunningham. And he's great, and he'll win the Tony, I think. But that show is up against the show called Come From Away, which is about the day that all the planes on September the 11th, after the attacks, when they pulled all the planes out of the air, many of them landed in Newfoundland. And this little town, in Newfoundland, Gander, regular population 12,000, suddenly had 25 jumbo jets from all over the world, with people worried and all the rest of it. And it's a sort of an inspiring show. It is interesting. I don't think it's a great piece of art, but it captures the moment. Like, it's Canadian. There's not been, here's an interesting quiz. How many Canadian musicals have ever made it to Broadway? The answer is about three only. And this is one of them. And Canadians are very, behind this show. And I think it's between those two. And then the third shot, a long shot, is probably Groundhog Day, which I like, is a funny,
that's a musical based on the movie
was shot here in Woodstock, Illinois.
Right. I grew up right out there.
Harold Ramis, Bill Murray. It has nothing to do with that sensibility. There's nothing in it. I know a lot of your listeners are fans of Harold Ramis, and he had a certain sensibility that you do not find in the musical at all. It's not a realistic depiction of small town Pennsylvania. It's kind of like Whoville. It's a very comic show, but it's clever and it's not bad. So it has. I don't think it's going to win for a moment, but those three probably are the best three new musicals. And then the best revival, far and away, is Bette Midler. I mean, I have been, I go to a show every night of my life, pretty much, or something like that anyway. And and I've never seen people stand up more. It was like, it was like they were on their feet. She said hi, and they all stood up. I mean, it was crazy.
Wow. So, is it? Do you think that's because the normal sort of Broadway goer has a history with Bette Midler?
They love Bette Midler.
They just love.
It's like it's like a worship. It's like the church of Bette Midler in there, and she's great, you know. And that show. You know, it's Bette Midler. What are you going to do, right? And she's you know, the night I was there, she had a coughing fit and couldn't start the song. And she got a standing ovation for coughing.
I mean, you know, right out of like
I'm like a nice work if you can get it.
Christopher Guest show.
Yeah.
Or a movie,
I mean, people
right?
were like, and she, you know, and then they gave her a glass of water and she said.
She's like, let me drink this. Oh, yes, drink.
That's right. And then she goes, live, dropping character completely. Live theater, standing ovation. And then right before the big song, she goes, get ready, wish me luck, here it comes. Standing ovation. Then she does the song before the parade.
Chris, that's crazy.
Another standing ovation.
That's all. I mean, I can't think of too many actresses that could do that.
No.
Like that could get up there and be like, I hope my voice holds up.
Like, got a standing ovation. It's quite, you know, somebody was saying to me that it's called a reservoir of goodwill. It's what United.
Right, yeah.
It's what United Airlines didn't have.
That's a good
a reservoir of goodwill.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, I think about the Broadway shows, and I feel more often than not, and I don't know if it's just because the world has changed in terms of media, but there used to be a time when you knew every the three Broadway musicals that were up, and you just explaining these to me, I feel like I gotta get it together.
You gotta get with it, man.
Like I just haven't been paying attention. But I mean, you go out to New York, you see these shows. I mean, is Broadway at the level that it usually is at?
It's been a good year. I mean, those shows make a lot of money. I mean, the thing about Broadway now is it's so damn expensive. I mean, get this. So most orchestra seats at Hello Dolly, if you wanted to go, just say in a couple of weeks, you know, here's Chris Jones on the download telling you it's a good show. You say, okay, why not? I'll go. And you want a good seat, you're going all the way to New York. I mean, it's a minimum of $500. It really is. For one seat, and really probably $700 on some night. I mean, for a really good seat.
People are paying it.
People pay it. And I think, you know, I actually blame Hamilton for that because I think it opened the floodgates of pricing.
To Hamilton, I haven't paid attention to their pricing, but I'm sure they paid
to
go see the show.
For a very good seat on a weekend night, you know, it's a lot of money. Now, you can argue, you know, I was at the Cubs on Sunday night against the Yankees. Sunday night, not even Saturday night, you know, and those seats for a family of four, by the time you're done, it's $600. But, you know, if you're in any... maybe even $1,000 by the time you've got your parking and your dog, and you know, a lot of people
couple
at the
of those Green Line, Goose Island,
couple
Green
of those
Line,
$10.50,
come on,
$10.
What's happening? I know we're talking theater, but what's happening? What's happening to the world we live in?
$10.50 for that Green Line. Yeah, and really the game, you know, a good game there is most people are paying $100 a ticket.
Yeah, I guess so. But
family of four is $500.
Yeah, but I mean. I guess that you're selling an experience with a great seat to see Bette Midler and Hello
Dolly.
Yes,
that's
like an experience you're going to live for, like history. Your family can talk about seeing this show 5 years from now. So I can understand there being an added value to it. But the idea of ponying up for a ticket, one ticket, $500, $700, seems at a certain point, you know, if Donald Trump wants to win over the populace, this might be where he steps in and goes, no, not going to happen. 200.
That's it.
Right?
That's it. You're fired.
Broadway. Back to the question about Chicago.
Yes.
So it was just those two actresses that aren't really Chicagoans. They came here for the tryout, but there's no other sort of Chicago.
Well, the other person, there is one, a good one, and that's Laurie Metcalf.
Right.
Know, a lot of people consider the greatest American actress. A lot of people who I respect would argue that she is one of, if not one of the very small number of truly great American stage actors working today, and TV actors for that matter. She's in a play called A Doll's House Part 2, which is a bizarre play where Nora, who's a character in this Ibsen play about a woman who leaves her wife in the Victorian era, she comes back and it's like a sequel. It's a sequel, basically. You see what happens when Nora comes back. Hmm. It's a bit of a, you know, you've got to know the original play. Now, many of your very educated listeners will, but not everybody.
I mean,
it's not a very well-known play. So, but Laurie's really good in it, and she may well win. she really may well win. And I, you know, that would be great. And
The Tonys, not unlike the Oscars or the Emmys, do they play to celebrities? Meaning you'll get more celebrities that have a chance to... Laurie Metcalf's a celebrity in the sense that people know her, and they know her already from her...
From Roseanne.
But just from her reputation on stage.
Yes.
Do you get to a point where that helps her as someone who
is... I think it does. Absolutely. I think it does. I think, you know, she... Speaking of reservoirs of goodwill, I mean, she might not be Bette Midler, but she's Laurie Metcalf, and I think she commands enormous respect in New York. Enormous respect, that actress. I'm always struck by that. Her and actresses like Cynthia Nixon, I think, is somebody else. Laura Linney, who also on Broadway this season. These are actors who are movie stars, but who... stage people really know have got the chops to work on, you know, on live theater.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Chris Jones, my guest here. All right. So before we wrap, though, before we go, the summer shows, like what Broadway shows have become? I mentioned
Something Rotten.
Which
King and I. Crickets in the room here. King and I is coming back. It's not that great, I got
to
tell you.
Getting to know you, that's all right. Getting to know all about you.
And then over in the parking lot of the United Center, we will have the Cirque du Soleil.
Okay.
Cirque du Soleil. So they will be here with their, you know, they're always good. You've been over there a few times. They're always good. They come about every 2 years, maybe every 2 to 3 years. They pitch their tent right by the United Center. That's coming in mid-July with a new show that I haven't seen yet, but I'm sure it's pretty good. So that's another big summer attraction. Okay. So, you know.
Chris Jones, chief theater critic of the Chicago Tribune, joins us regularly here on The Download.
Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for being here, man.
Watch out for the robbers.
All right. Coming up tomorrow, RTA Chairman Kirk Dillard's going to be here. I'm excited to talk with him because, you know, he, of course, a former state senator who now is running the RTA. But, Metra, PACE, the entire sort of grid that we have our sort of regional transportation on is really susceptible to funding cuts or not getting funding increases, especially when it comes to, you know, politics. And... you know, I mean, the Metra is essentially a Chicago project. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. Transportation, there was an article in the Tribune not too long ago just about the concerns and the worries coming from the RTA about some of the big projects, the infrastructure projects, and just the idea of being able to cover budget. They have the same kind of issues in transportation, Metra, and all those kind of things. So Chairman... I guess you call him chairman, right? Yeah. Dillard will be here. Also, we'll reload this week's news. Randy Bellisomo is going to be here. Kevin Warwick from The Reader. Excited to talk with those guys. And we'll do a little bit more from the Download Live to Tape. We did that last Friday, some of the interviews. We have some more as we sort of ramp up to live shows this summer. So a lot going on. That's all coming up tomorrow night. Right now, in the next 8 minutes, Patty Vasquez is back from Springfield. She had great success with the interview with Speaker Madigan. So she'll talk about, she'll round up all the fun she had and conversations she had in Springfield tonight on the program. So that's cool. And like I said, tomorrow, Saturday is a huge day for me. It is when I start my move to the 2017 garden. And it's not even a garden. It's a flower patch.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to take listeners' advice, the two things I took from today. Someone or something's urine. And fake animals.
Mm-hmm.
Like plastic animals. Those are the two things that would best deter rabbits from eating my Home Depot flowers.
A woman called up and suggested garlic powder.
I will say this because we had the same thing with Tabasco, and I tried it last year, and the same principles with the urine. I understand the concept that maybe the urine scares the rabbits away, but its concept is to try and make the plants taste bad. When you're a hungry rabbit, just like a hungry human, you'd be like, "Yeah, it tastes bad, but I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still going to eat this."
Yeah.
They don't seem to care. Like, I think the concept in general of covering it,
That's not going to work. You just want them away.
So I need to figure out. I was thinking like maybe chicken wire underneath the, like all the way around the place. That's not going to work aesthetically. That's not going to look good. I like the idea of trying to go scarecrow-like with plastic animals. We'll try that. Although I have a feeling that'll just be stolen.
You try to sign rabbits keep out.
That's possible too. Someone said a pellet gun, which I do not endorse, but maybe. You know, just kind of lean it inside the window.
Mm-hmm.
You know, almost like
scare them.
Right. Just a little quick scare. Yeah. We got a problem here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you kind of lift the shirt up. Let them know what's up. The pellet gun's in the waistband of my sweatpants. And then I Plaxico myself. Ow! Ow! So those are my options. But I'm the one piece of information, my wife told me that... she's seeing this sort of building of a nest happening a couple doors down.
Hmm.
Like they will take a bunch of foliage and things and kind of put it together before they're going to make babies. So that's good because at least they've decided
somewhere else.
They're not coming back to my yard. Last summer, that was the big issue that the rabbit had babies underneath my bush.
Mm-hmm.
And then because they, you know, don't branch out, they stay inside the yard, they had plentiful source of, you know, fruits,
things,
vegetables,
yeah.
Nibble flowers, mm-hmm. nibblers. So, yeah. So I'm feeling like...
Well, this is a big breakthrough.
Yeah. Well, that's good, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. 630 says, if rabbits are the problem, plant carrots nearby. I get this because Churchill hit me up on Facebook too. Said the same thing. Chris Churchill, he's been a guest on the show. He's like, what if you planted carrots nearby and then they eat those and they wouldn't eat your flowers? I'm like, that sounds terrible because they're going to finish those carrots like in one day and they'd be like, oh, there's more.
They'll finish the carrots, and then they'll go to the flowers because they're still hungry, and then they'll come back and want more carrots.
Yeah, and they'll just be hanging out.
Brand. Yeah.
And be like all these teenage rabbits just hanging out on my stoop. Come on, guys. I got no more carrots. Stop intimidating me.
Yeah. Carrots a gateway to your flowers.
Yeah, exactly. I just want to discourage any eating in the area, if that makes sense. All right. Well, thanks for your help, everybody.